basis of the kids-related industries and the Fidel in particular, we formed partnerships with other defense companies. And these partnerships are essentially effective through the decision molding of the that required us to refine and develop the concept of molding kids. Essentially gives the state, in this case, some very defined rights, reserved rights. In our case, clearly we're seeking to ensure that the subsidiary will continue to meet the objectives that we have for the defense-related sector alone. So it deals with issues like the change of ownership, the collaborative project across the big state-owned enterprise. And use their strengths and the possible synergies that could emerge from that to achieve larger economic objectives. And I think that process has worked well. And I'll come in a moment to some of the new areas that I think we'll be working on and are working on this year. But I believe we made progress in the disposal of state property. State-owned enterprise property, we were able to agree a set of guidelines and processes which dealt with all of the disposal processes, and the big ones being, of course, Transnet. Not been an easy process, it's been quite a lengthy process, but I think that we've been able to ensure that there's a systematic and coordinated approach to the disposal of non-core property in a manner that achieves, particularly, broad-based black economic empowerment objectives. And goes one step further, I think, and tries to ensure that local economies and local communities get some additional preference for properties in their area. So I think the benefits of this coordinated work are very useful indeed. We've also been able to reach some quite substantial agreements between the state-owned enterprises and other public departments, public sector departments, the main one being housing, where land has been released for specifically for housing. But there have also now been a number of initiatives that relate to educational institutions, etc. What's going more slowly, and inevitably it will go more slowly, is that component which I think you're familiar with, which is more developmental. So what do we do with land that may or may not be needed around ports? The advantages, I think, of this joint project stability is shown by the property project. Now, the key projects that we're working on here, and some are really very large indeed, would be the whole concept of supplier development. This is using the leverage of the big builds in Transnet, Pebble Bed, and Eskom to strengthen, develop, and improve South Africa's manufacturing capacity and performance. This is a sensible approach. It's essentially an economic and commercial approach. Because in the world today, where the growth of the giant economy is having such a powerful impact on all supply conditions for all forms of equipment, if South Africa is going to continue over the next 20 years to develop its infrastructure to much higher levels, it really does need more secure supply conditions. It needs to ensure that it can attain more secure supply conditions for various forms of capital equipment, etc. And that's what the competitive supply program is about. It's about a coordinated approach to procurement that tries to maximize the competitive supplier base in South Africa, and I stress that because it would be useless to try and maximize the supplier base if just raise your cost structure. It's really got to be a competitive supplier base. And I'm very pleased that we're making good progress on that. The competitive supply development plans of Eskom and Transnet in particular are now under discussion, and they have to be approved by other departments, particularly trade and industry, before they would replace real development around that. A very interesting component of the competitive supply development program, I believe, is a very important one, which emerges out of the Africa project in the department. This was a project in the joint project facility designed to see what role the state-owned enterprises could, should play in the African economy. I think you'll recall we felt that our previous attempts were somewhat ineffective and that we should do something more effective. Now, one of the things that emerged as a very concrete and interesting proposal is in fact the use of the Competitive Supply Development Program to link with other African economies. There's been a program agreed upon with the UNIDO, which is the United Nations Industrial Development Organization, where we would use them to benchmark potential suppliers. So we would then benchmark potential suppliers in other African economies, and I think we hope to achieve some very concrete links, trade links and investment links between ourselves and the African economies. So these cross-cutting projects, I think, are important. The other big one that's emerged as part of an overall package is the work you can't hear him. What emerged in this was what we call the South African Power Project, which is a large project done with Mineral and Energy, Science and Technology, Trade and Industry, examining how we could leverage in industrial and manufacturing and technological capacity into this build program. I think it's an exciting project. It's been tabled in Cabinet, the work program has been approved. The more detailed propositions that will emerge from this would only emerge after the July Cabinet, of course. But I think it's an interesting project broadly to look at how we can leverage more capacity into the South African economy from the big build program in energy. This is linked closely then to skills and other indicators. Particularly Eskom Transnet and our Pebblebed play an active role in the JIPSA program, led by the Deputy President, and the need for skills in this, as we go forward in the South African economy is well known. But we've been able to quantify that more effectively and been able to very significantly increase the contribution that the state-owned enterprises are making to the development of the skills program. So with the cross-cutting projects of the state-owned enterprises, I believe we've made a lot of progress, and the task this year is essentially to get those projects in process. They're not quick, 6, 1 year, 2 month type projects. These are projects that are going to have to go forward over a long period of time if we're going to finish their objectives. Very briefly then, I'll go into more detail. The biggest challenges we face are not new. It's ensuring that we build very large infrastructural programs. It's ensuring that we restructure some of the enterprises, ensuring that we try and return SAA to profitability. And the challenges there are well known, I'll touch on them briefly. Let me start with two of the smaller but not unimportant areas. I believe that the settlement of the Restless Veld land claim was a major breakthrough in trying to resolve complicated land claims. So the challenge we now face this year is to actually complete that settlement agreement. That is to ensure that we revive mining, that we do it now jointly with the community through pooled and shared joint venture, which is in progress, an interesting program. We also this year are in negotiations with De Beers, arising out of an agreement between De Beers and the Department of Mineral and Energy, as to whether there could be some overall rationalization of the diamond mining in the Namakwaland area. This is an interesting and challenging proposition. Its success would be very important in stabilizing the whole Namakwaland economy, because the land-based mining in the Beers and to a lesser extent in Alexport is certainly reaching near the end of its life. That slide will take the context of the facility. But if it's mined carefully and we can find some coordinated rationalization of that, we could prolong that mining for a longer period. And I think it's an important objective. In the Alexport situation, we have now transferred the non-mining activities across to the community. And I think this poses a fascinating opportunity and challenge to that community to develop economic activity under the control of the community and the companies that are joining. So it's a very, very challenging and interesting opportunity. Its success would bode well for other complicated land reform programs. And I think we take it very seriously, trying to make certain that we work closely with the community to achieve their objectives. A similar process faces us in SAFCOM. The department will take you through that more quickly. The decision by government, after a long review, that government should exit the forestry is, I believe, correct. The strategic objectives for forestry, forestation, the control of forestry, can be achieved through the Department of Water Affairs and Forestry, through the licensing process for forestation, and through the leases that are given. Because remember, we will not alienate any land in SAFCOM. It remains held by the state, and any user is using it on a lease basis, subject to the land claims, which I'll touch on in a moment. So, I believe we feel confident that the objectives for forestry, and this is a relatively complex industry, can be achieved by the power that the state has to control forestry and forestation. Attempting to run a state-owned enterprise in the sector, in our view, is not a strategic necessity. Therefore, we propose the exit. However, what is now very clear is that any proposed transaction actually has to be predicated on the resolution of the land claim. We do need to work now more intensely with land affairs to resolve and clarify these land claims, because that will help us to determine the exact partnership that could be developed between the forestry project and that community. So, this process, the SAFCOM process, will not be resolved quickly. It was our target to try and get as much finality as possible by the end of this coming financial year. We may or may not be able to achieve that. I think one of the key factors is going to be the speed with which some very complicated and numerous land claims can actually be defined, resolved, and the agreement reached on it. So, in Alexco and SAFCO, we are essentially dealing with the complexities of land restitution, but also the opportunity of achieving that land restitution effectively and in a sustainable manner, and I think it's a major challenge. Very quickly, in the energy sector, I think we're now very familiar with the challenges and issues we face. going to be our challenge this year is to keep getting our stabilizing our system and moving out of an emergency situation to a more stable situation. This is going to bring forward a lot of the work that was planned for later years, particularly to intensify the demand management side, which is crucial, led in the main by mineral and energy, but in which Eskom and BP can play a key role. But it will also bring forward very rapidly the programs of cogeneration, and we intend to expand to the extent that it can speed up the build program, the independent power producer. The work that has been planned to take place over a few years, we have to fast track into 2 years. And I think this is going to be an additional challenge for Eskom. We are working with Eskom to see how we reorganize our program to deal with these new challenges. But the energy sector, I think, is really one of our major areas in which we're coming. And the development of the pebble bed and the introduction of pressurized water reactors into the system also means a great deal of new work to be done in the whole area of the nuclear field, how that was done, work with mineral energy, work with science and technology, work with NEXA, work, a lot of intense work with the regulator to develop South Africa's capacity deal with a much larger nuclear build in South Africa. So in energy, certainly a great deal of challenges, and we would begin to fast-track some of the other technologies that we've been looked at for some time now by Eskom. Our current view is that in South Africa, the greatest scope for significant expansion of new technologies like solar, both photovoltaic and shortly after that in what's called concentrated solar power technology. So this is one of the projects we'll be fast-tracking, various solar panels and geysers and other appliances that can use solar energy. The other area that we'll be doing a great deal more work on would be various forms of underground coal gasification. Is a really pilot project at Machuga, which middle of this year we will start using the gas from that for Machuga in one of the units. So we'll fast track the underground coal gasification area. But I think that the response to events by a whole range of private sector players has been very encouraging indeed, and convinces us that we can be more energy efficient, but in being more energy efficient, we're also opening a whole lot of new opportunities for the development of manufacturing activities in South Africa. In the transport sector, in Transnet, the challenge is to continue the build program, do it quickly, and we will have to this year reach agreement on the precise the precise process to implement the new Port Act and the role that each party will play. This is quite a key area. The project in port is going reasonably well. After the delay, we're in a much better position now in Cape Town. But there's a lot of work to do with the new regulatory structures in transport. There's a lot of work to do to continue to improve the capacity and efficiency of Transnet freight rail. We, I think, made progress last year, and this is very useful in moving the passenger transport, to Department of Transport, and I think this has allowed Metro Rail to concentrate and be very active in developing its own capacity. It is still our objective to move Shortalota, the intercity passenger service, part of the project, and we're working on that. airlines. The restructuring program for SAA is going reasonably well. The industry is an extremely volatile one. And our main challenge this year, I think, is to find a way to provide capital for SAA. The impression that large amounts of money have been pumped into SAA is not accurate. It's been done to guarantee not large quantities of money. And essentially, the airlines, in our view, remains undercapitalized, and we have to work to find a way to inject capital, as we've indicated. We have had support, very important support from the National Treasury, but we do have to find a more stable formula for SAA for the capital injection. We've made progress with South African Express, and I think this allows for a much clearer representation of the airline industry and the clarification of the precise roles of the regional carrier, SA Express, the low-cost carrier, Mango, and the main passenger carrier, SAA. It remains a very challenging industry, a very important industry for the South African economy that we have to work on. Finally, and very quickly, three last areas. Broadband InfraCo now on the move. I think we'll begin to see the impact of this in pricing. The national terrestrial system doing well, and we now are moving very quickly to deal with the phase two of broadband InfraCo, which is the undersea cable on the roof. So we've been moving very quickly on those processes, and I believe that we'll begin to get the benefits of that, particularly as we move into the licensing process. The ETA amendments have been approved, so we will be able to move relatively quickly, depending on the licensing process, to open broadband infrastructure to wider citizens. I touched briefly on the NEL. I think the process is going relatively well. The restructuring is doing relatively, we're pleased with the process. We do need to complete further restructuring. We must find and reach a consolidation of the land system sector in the NEL and with other South African companies. And we have to make very important decisions this year on exactly how we deal with what's called dynamics, which is the power sector, and we have to make important decisions on going on this year. So, for the NEL, once again, it's quite an interesting and challenging year in what's happening. Let me conclude, Chair, by just saying that within the department, as they were outlined fully, I think that I'm very satisfied and pleased with the amount of work we've been able to deal with, and with the structure that we've been developing over the last few years to deal with some of these very complicated negotiations and processes. I think for me, speaking directly about the department, we've been able to fulfill our responsibilities to the best of our ability across all of the SOEs. Even in the midst of what's a pretty severe situation in the energy sector, where a lot of effort has had to go into making sure that we work closely with Eskom and Midland Energy to deal with the current emergency. So I think that the work that's been done in the department is settling down very well, and I'm confident that at the end of this administration we'll be able to leave a very comprehensive set of accurate and easily traceable records as to what's been done over the last 5 years and provide a platform and a basis for the next administration to work on some of the systems that are operational and mechanisms and procedures inside the department that are proving to be effective. And lastly, thank you for the work you've been able to do with yourself as the committee and yourself, chairperson. Once again, we would encourage to see as much of the portfolio as possible. These are big and complicated systems, and your personal observation and experience is very useful, I think, in allowing you to fill an oversight role. And we look forward to our school where we can go into some depth and detail of some of the complexities of the challenges facing
had the next 2 days, today, tomorrow, and Friday, so 2.5 days, to deal with and the duty will be here for all of that time, and no doubt that each of you will be in as well. So I think that what I'm suggesting is that certain of the broad scale questions are coming, we just keep them off a very intensive conversation. So the minister is unfortunately going to have to be back around 11:30. So whatever issues members have to raise with the minister, I think this is the opportunity. Can I get an indication of my diet? For 1 minute. Okay, the 2 at this stage. Don't think something like that.
Thank you, Chair, and thanks, Minister, for the information. Just for clarity purposes, I just want you to know whether you can just elaborate on the things that I'm going to mention. We are glad that the Alex Gore community are settled, and we're also glad that the government will support the community as far as possible. But as far as the mine itself concerned, I want to know whether that was what you actually said, that the peers and the private companies can get more involved in the performance of the mine itself. But as far as the community concerned, I think it is the responsibility of the community to support it as far as possible. The other thing that I just want to get more clarity, Chairperson, from the Minister, SACPOL, are there any claims on SACPOL property plantation? And you mentioned something about the transfer or the possibility that it's actually belongs to the Department of Forestry. Should it not be done at the end of the day, or just be phased out? What is it worth for our department, for this department, to keep SACPOL as a SOE instead of transferring to another department or No. So land claims, if there are land claims, but then the whole of SACPOL, all the properties there, whether they're all plantations, the whole country. Then my last question, Chairperson, is just concerning the money allocated for the ESCOM capital expenditure. Now, last year, we are treasury, ESCOM are treasury for 79 billion for its capital expenditure, and then it increased to 150 billion, and then this year to 300 billion. And I realized that Minister Manuel in his budget speech referred to 343 million. But in the newspaper, it's been said by Mr. Brian James that even the 1,300 billion up to 2025 will still be not enough in the power supply for the future. Now, taking into account that Minister Manuel allocated 60 billion over the next 5 years, what is the intention of his supported department to obtain additional capital in the future? Will there be ESCOM obligations, except for international loans and other things? What else are they going to get to fulfill the need for this huge capital expenditure program, seeing the fact that it's not the international government, that the need is much higher? And do you think that we will be successful taking into account the grading of ESCOM's financial situation? Can you just elaborate a little bit more on the financial position of ESCOM in the future so that it can comply with our needs? Thank you.
Maybe let me start by telling you this morning when I was coming here, SASM, there was an article that was talking about the problem caused by the coal issue and so on. Maybe I'm clarifying those issues, but I think that I'm not sure whether it's been duplicated to the other languages so that people can understand, but I was telling it very well. The second one, Chair, is in relation to the issue of private business. and drop out the week and have a finish. I'm sure FACC school this morning they had extensive problems around the particular net. I think in that level, I think whoever tries that when they keep coming, they are doing very well because they're trying to expose other revenue or options in terms of generation of energy. But my question, Chair, would be around the Minister, that it will seem that after the engagement with the money in that, and everyone was asking about the agreement in terms of the cutting 10% and so on. But now I'm not sure, in my view, we are seeing a situation where opportunistic mine companies threatening about the retrenchment under the pretext of the 10% reduction of energy. The issue, of course, is where they are threatening 6,900 job cuts and so on. Whether is any plan maybe at your level or at ISCOM in terms of how to mitigate back the content. But although I'm not sure whether it's really the cause of the 10% cut or because there's other argument to say anyway they had those plans before even the power crisis and so on to retrench, but now they seem to be using the energy cut and so on. Just to check what means are there to mitigate around those particular issues as they are rising of in part of government. The other issue is in relation to the issue of skills impact. I just want to check whether at your level are you engaging with the counterparts and the Minister for Communication in terms of how to mitigate that, because I realize that they've been given some money and they are also talking about rollout. But for that we don't see any duplication targeting one in the same area, so that there's any engagement at that level for policy direction, so that we don't have duplication sensing.
Okay,
that's
Just a comment first this morning. For some reason at about 4:30 or 5 o'clock on, I was up and listening to CNN. I don't know if it was in Florida or one of the United States states. There was a power failure yesterday. And they blamed it on money not being spent on upkeep of the infrastructure, on old equipment. And it just sounded very similar or familiar to me at that time of the morning. Two questions to the Minister. Maybe we should export some of our skills to that. Two questions. You were saying, Minister, that there was no large-scale transfer of capital to SAA. Now, the 1.3 billion rand in June last year, was that a guarantee or was that actual cash that was transferred? Secondly, the question of Alex Core. Now, 51% is owned by Alex Core and 49% by the community. What is the intention of government going forward regarding ownership of Alex Core?
You're going to come to the second round, okay? But I just wanted you to address the one issue. You may know that the committee is, well, certainly not from Mr. Van Dyke, I think the ANC components of this committee, essentially, is I don't think it will be too hard to say diametrically opposed to the issue of Sasol being privatized. And the argument essentially, it seems to me, is based on, and I'm new, so I can basically sit on the fence on this one at this stage. But it seems to me that Sasol is, and while you're part of what your concerns are, is that Sasol is no longer a strategic player in the sense that it doesn't have a huge market in in the forestry industry anymore. I mean, it used to, but we sold off a number of its assets sometimes. But strategically, it's not a big player. But having said all of that, clearly it's a profitable venture. Given that it employs a good number of people, it may not employ as many people as it used to, but it certainly still employs a substantial number of people, the issue of land claims and so on, seems to me to make it a worthwhile asset, so to say. Now, clearly there are other factors that you would have considered to basically allude to the decision to privatize. From your perspective, how is it that the state ultimately would benefit? And it's not a question of whether Tesco is or isn't a strategic asset to keep, but how would the state benefit in the, shall we say, unbundling of Tesco and Komati?
Thank you, Chair. There's quite a number of detailed questions, so sorry if I take the time to answer. On Alex Core, let me deal with two areas there. Essentially, the state owns Alex Core and would retain its ownership. I'll come to what its final state could be in a moment when we look at some of the other factors, but the state retains Alex Core. Now, our mechanism to transfer the land and the mining rights, this is important, to the community is to establish what's called a pooled and shared joint venture. So the mining done in the Alex Core area will now be done by the pooled and shared joint venture. But there's a process and it takes some time. We can go into more detail if you like, but it's there's a whole lot of steps that have to be followed in this, and the process of transferring the mining rights and finalizing the PSJV as a company will take us to late this year, early next year. It's going to take quite a bit of time to get all that done. Lots of things on how we can work with Mineral and Energy to get the mining rights transferred. So the objective we have is that the PSJV would take over the mining process. Now you'll recall that the land claim only had reference to the land mining. The marine diamonds are not part of that land claim. But as part of the settlement, the state through Alex Core are putting in the sea mining activities into the PSJV. And those of you who've had the time to look at that very complex agreement will see that at some point, should we exit the PSJV, because the community can take over the PSJV, then there are procedures to deal with what would happen to the marine mining. But you can immediately see that Alex Core would remain the owners of that marine mining right. So this is the process we now are trying to undertake, to get the mining moving again, to introduce the PSJV into the mining process. We have to do it fairly carefully through the steps of the law, because in law, that still remains Alex Core's property. So we've introduced the PSJV interim structure that's gaining experience and developing this process. The question of the Beers and what role they could or could not play is still a matter for negotiation. Essentially, Mineral and Energy reached an agreement with De Beers about some other outstanding claims, in which De Beers said, well, we would be prepared to try and give you 20% of the assets in the Makwaland area, but what we're exploring is there's not some logic in rationalizing this into a total mining structure. But to do that, we still have to protect the community, their rights, their ownership. So it's by no means a simple discussion or transaction that we're looking at here. So whether there would be some arrangement that to help us in mining of on Alex Core on the land and on the sea, we would reach an agreement with De Beers or Transex or other subcontractors. How that's done is all covered by the settlement agreement, but we have not reached any finality on that. So, in short, the Alex Core would remain state-owned. If we reach some agreement in the long term with the whole Namakwaland area, we may decide to exit it, we may decide to keep a shareholding, we may decide to have a golden share. I would be pretty certain that we would, at the minimum, exercise golden share rights, because we have an obligation to the community that goes well beyond any commercial arrangement. You know, we've got to make sure that there's some protection for that community over time. The extent to which other companies get involved in the mining immediately is still under negotiation, how we would do that. With regard to SAFCO, and your question and yours question, Shepherd, yes, if you can remember, I think it's a very substantial part of the land, 80%. 80% of Kamati land, forest land. So that we should just distinguish between SAFCO, which is the company that has assets, and then its biggest asset is KLF, Kamati Land Forest. So 80% of that is under land claim. Now the validity of each of those claims is not finalized yet. So it might be under claim. Whether in fact that's a valid claim and what the implications are is not finalized. But this gives us a lot of difficulties. So that's the situation we face, and that's why we really have to resolve the validity, extent of the land claims and who the claimants are. Because if we want to reach some agreement with those claimants, we have to be very clear who they are in law. And this is a matter that's been ongoing for some time now, that really has to be resolved, and we'll work more closely with Land Affairs to resolve it. Because whichever way, we can't really move anyway on SAFCOM unless those things are resolved. Now, we'd be very happy to come and have once again a much longer discussion on SAFCOM. The view of government was that after a long review of KLF, Kamati Land Forest, was that government should not retain it in ownership. That we can achieve the same objective that we want to achieve by disposing of it. Let me just clarify that. I mean, the obvious objectives that we want to achieve would be to help the community economically, both the claimants and the broad community. If we could diversify ownership of our forests and bring in both communities and previously disadvantaged people, there's a lot of merit to that, which is important. Very important for Mpumalanga and parts of Limpopo province, KLF. We'll learn lessons from the previous privatization, which has not been as successful as we would have wanted, so we'll have to take that into account. The other objective clearly would be that we would want to keep that land largely under afforestation. Now KLF, although it's a relatively small part of the total industry, I should get the figure, it's about 9% or something. It's a relatively large part of the saw log industry. There's about 30% of that industry. So from a point of view of the supply of saw logs for timber, for manufacturing and construction timber, furniture, etc., it's quite important. So one would want to keep it largely involved in that rather than allow it to move right across to pulping or something like that, which would seriously destabilize the saw logs. But those objectives can be achieved through the lease agreement. And they can be achieved through the licensing agreement. So forestry, you can't just jump up into a forest. You've got to deal with the Department of Forestry. If it's on state land, you would have to lease it. And if it's on, in any event, you've got to get a license to be a forester. Because there's certain requirements to run a forest you have to follow. Now these are very significant and substantial provisions that exist, so the state's objectives can be built into those leases. We would not alienate the land. We don't believe that would be wise. It's far better to keep that land most successful forestry systems around the world are effectively take place in state land. South Africa is a bit unusual. We've got large private holdings of land as well. So we can spend more time discussing and debating that, but the long and the short of it is that we think we can achieve some very important empowerment objectives, economic development objectives for Mpumalanga and Limpopo, but maintain the afforestation objectives through the lease holding and other things. For the state to run a relatively profitable enterprise and employ people only makes sense if you quite convinced the market wouldn't do it. Whereas in this case, we absolutely convinced the market forces would do this. They would run these enterprises. And you don't have to rely only on the market forces, because in your leasing and your licensing, you can achieve those objectives anyway. But we're happy to come back. It's not just I've gone quickly and be very comfortable for our team to brief again and we'd have a look at it and show you the intricacies of the deal and what we need to do. On Eskom, now let's just, sorry, do a quick ABC of Eskom's financing, because it's all too often in the media this thing gets completely jumbled and messed up and misunderstood. Okay. Now Eskom is a state-owned enterprise. It's got its own balance sheet, and as the Minister of Finance said, I think it's never been capitalized since, what, 1928 or something. So it's a very powerful utility. And I think currently by revenue it's the seventh largest in the world. So we're not talking about a baby here, you're talking about a very big entity. A very strong balance sheet. From recent work we've done, it's one of a handful of large electricity companies that actually have got a rating roughly equal to their sovereign. Very few others in our world have got that. So we've got a very high rating at Eskom. Now, what that means is that the electricity price is a regulated price. So Eskom doesn't go and charge whatever price it wants. Now, the model that the regulator uses, and this is what will come up for some discussion, is to allow for a rate of return on assets. I'm simplifying a little bit. There's other recoverable costs and all sorts of things. So it says, all right, you can charge this price. That will allow you to earn sufficient revenue to make a profit. So Eskom's profits arise from the fact that the regulator gives us a price. If those profits are too big, the regulator can claw them back. If they're too small, you've got a problem. So it's not an ordinary company, it's a regulated company. The price is regulated. And essentially what the regulator, the shareholder ministry, the policy ministry try and do is to create a formula for pricing that allows Eskom to earn a sufficient rate of return on assets that to finance its capital, it then uses its balance sheet to borrow. So the gearing ratio, the balance between equity or retained earnings and borrowing in Eskom is roughly 50-50. They borrow 50% and they use 50% of what they need from their retained earnings. So that's how the model works. It doesn't go to Treasury for any money. So when the Treasury talks about the money, 340, 171, that's not money Treasury provides. That is the amount that Eskom will be spending on capital, and roughly it will borrow half of that amount in the capital market and finance half of it from retained earnings. Now the problem that arises, and this is why we've only now started discussing with Treasury, not for Treasury come by money, but how do we strengthen the balance sheet of Eskom? Because what's happening is, on the current price trajectory, the revenue that Eskom will earn in relation to what it has to spend to build means that the retained earnings drop. So the retained earnings drop, that means it's got to borrow more, and what happens is its gearing ratio rises. Gearing means the ratio of borrowing to equity or retained earnings. As your gearing ratio rises, obviously anyone lending you money gets nervous, wouldn't it? They say, you're borrowing so much, but your revenue is not enough to repay that. So that's the situation which could lead to a rating drop. So they say, look, you've got to build all of this, but the prices that we see the regulator giving you from past experience are too low. So you won't be able, you'll have to borrow more and more and more. This will overextend you in the capital market, reduce your rating. So to correct that, we have to improve two things. We will increase prices so that the revenue rises, and also to force people to be more efficient. And we've got to look at whether the state has to put capital in. Now, the tight periods are the next 2 or 3 years. And that's why the Minister of Finance said, okay, we would be prepared to support you over the next 5 years. We're prepared to make available a potential 60 billion. Now, how that would be given is still a matter for a lot of discussion. Would it require cash, or is it a guarantee that qualifies as capital, or a long-term loan that qualifies as capital? These are very intricate issues which we would be happy to talk about when, as I said once before, when we've got greater clarity with all the parties, we'll brief everyone on that. So the when we talk of 150, 342, 1.3 trillion, you're talking about the cost of building the infrastructure we need. What that will how that will affect the Eskom balance sheet depends on the price of electricity and the rate of return that we agree to self-finance. Because we would like to keep Eskom's rating high. That means you can't allow the gearing ratio to shift too high over a long period of time. And there's certain other ratios which are very important. What people look at is the amount of money you're earning, the revenue you're earning, is it sufficient to cover your interest payments? So if the amount of money that you're earning in cash is dropping below your interest payments, clearly that's a worrying situation. And that's what you would have to look at to correct. But essentially, Eskom's balance sheet, provided we get the pricing formula into the future right, and electricity prices in South Africa have to go up. This is no option. They have to go up. We've been moving them up too slowly. Then its balance sheet should remain strong. And as the Minister of Finance said, and our objective is to retain Eskom as essentially an enterprise that does not receive budgetary subventions. Will be capitalized if we have to and allow it to move forward. So I hope I've kind of clarified how this works in the Eskom financing. Coal, I think we've dealt with it in previous presentations. It's a tight coal market. Everyone's having these difficulties getting coal in the right quantities. And as the price of coal rises on the export markets, each national utility has more difficulty getting the coal. Also, highly priced coal means that if you hold big stockpiles, it's expensive. So the balance between stockpiles that meet your needs but are not too expensive in terms of financing, these are all some of the commercial complexities that Eskom has to deal with. On the mining issue, we are a little bit unhappy with the way in which this thing has emerged, because we understood we had an agreement that these matters would be discussed amongst ourselves. But this arises apparently from a survey done in the Chamber of Mines, which has now been released to the media, or the media have seen it. But the Minister of Mineral and Energy will meet with the mines again on Thursday. We have been in detailed discussion with them. The processes, as they know only too well, and as the union leaders have indicated, there's some very clearly agreed protocols for how this has to be done. So as I said in the earlier energy briefing, we must always be cautious of press announcements on these things, because really the process to achieve that is a complicated and negotiated process. Now, let us say that, as we've indicated all along, we would really like to accommodate the mining industry. And this is why we're putting so much pressure and effort into getting the other sectors of the economy to save. Because it's very difficult to give more energy to mining if other sectors aren't saving, because then we have to go back to the load shedding. So we're in negotiation with them. There'll be meetings again tomorrow. And it must obviously be everyone's objective to avoid retrenchment. Whether these are entirely attributable only to the Coopers. I've been a unionist for so many years. I know that you often use any event to explain something you're going to do before anyway. So I think these are matters that will be negotiated and discussed in some detail. With regard to Infraco and Centec, these are entirely complementary structures. There's absolutely no policy problem or commercial problem or clash between these. It's entirely complementary structure. Infraco only deals with fiber optic cabling, and it only deals with the intercity network and the undersea network. That's all it deals with. Centec is a signal operation. It deals with wireless, no wire systems. And there's a tremendous scope for complementarity, which is why from our side we've always been very supportive of Centec being funded, because their job is to complete the whole system, to roll out wireless systems that would, you can think of it as a whole lot of little loops, which all that information eventually has to go from one city to another. As soon as it wants to go from one city to another, it gets into the Infraco system and starts moving. So these are entirely complementary structures. In fact, we've got a project now in KwaZulu-Natal where the two organizations are working together to try and improve broadband accessibility to very populated areas of KZN. So they're complementary. I mean, we've always been very supportive of Centec getting funds. Florida and everyone else, you know, I agree. I think it's remarkable how quickly the energy situation changes in the world. 60s and 70s, I'm sure most of you have done this, but if you go back and read the government white paper of 1998, it correctly summarizes world opinion at that time, which is not long ago, 10 years ago, where the world had come to the conclusion that some of the predictions of the Club of Rome and other projections in the 70s, that there would be severe shortages of energy. By the 90s, early 90s, people felt there would be no such shortages. But what you had in places like Europe was massive new energy systems built on Russian gas. So there was trade of energy, development of these power pools, the privatization of energy companies, and in the 90s people felt the market would solve all these problems. By early 2001, the market said, no, this is not going to work. And I think it was California that was the really big wake-up call, because there you had quite a mature privatized system. Regulated system, but it was evident that each of the players in that market was not investing heavily enough. So as demand rose, they just were not far-sighted enough, they're not right. Which led to the swing back to the state playing a much more active role. The long supply lines like Russia have made people very nervous, because if you have a problem, a political or technical problem with your long supply lines, suddenly your economy is thrown into chaos. And this is why I think that nuclear energy is inevitable. That's why everyone's turning back to it. It's got the advantages of emissions. The technology of dealing with waste is improving continuously. But you need national systems that can give you baseload. And the renewables can't give you baseload. So this is a big, big change in energy systems. Virtually every energy system in the world has been caught underinvested. Or like South Africa, where when we get to the distribution and transmission side, or more the distribution, we really have got to make sure we improve that, because that equipment's old, and we have to improve it. So this is a challenge that everyone knew from about 2003-4. People realized, okay, we're going to have to change the model here. Privatization is not going to work. You're going to have a mixed system, state and private. And you're going to have state regulation much, much tighter, and you're going to have far more national capacity, which led to the nuclear. These are all very recent changes in the world economy. What's amazing is that it's happened in less than 10 years. And the impact of China and India has just been staggering. on the whole energy sector. The on SAA, the SAA's problem is very little cash has been put in. The 1.3 billion was a guarantee. Cash now has gone in for specific purposes of the restructuring. Now, a guarantee helps you with your technical balance sheet, but doesn't necessarily help you with usable capital that you can use. It's got limitations. It's important, but it's got limitations. So, there's the 6 billion that was used to deal with the hedge book. That was effected through Transnet, not money that went into SRA. It was money that was used in Transnet when it was the owner. And the guarantees associated with that are sitting in Transnet, not in SRA. So the impression that we've pumped massive amounts of money into SRA is not correct. We've had to restructure, use guarantees, and there's been this recent injection to deal with the actual restructuring costs. And this is why we have to look at this. I mean, other airlines around the world, the state usually pumps in significant quantities of money. Private companies too. For the United States, the government runs money into the private airlines, not even the state airlines. Yeah. So we've got to look at that more carefully. I hope I've touched on the classical issue and we can certainly have a much longer session on it. Some
I think second round members, Dr. Van Dyk, I have Mr. Gololo first from the last session, so Mr. Gololo first, Dr. Van Dyk. Going. I'm making sure. And you don't have chance to put it on the floor. We'll do those two and then I'll come in after
Thank you very much, Captain. I just want to go back to the aviation part of the SAA. In that, you know, I just want to know the state of affairs with regard to SAA Link. You know, recently I saw the new fleet there. In fact, there's a new introduction of some bigger airplanes operating in the eastern part of the country, like Malaga, Cape Town, and all that. So that we really appreciate that, I must say. But now, of course, it's more than a concern, the minister, that, you know, in the past 2 weeks of travel, I've been traveling between the routes, and I see those airplanes, they look new, actually, and they are BAE, that is, I think they're British. I just wanted to find out from you as to whether those planes are leased, or you purchased those planes. But if you get inside those planes, they've got new seats. And surprisingly, when they try to close those doors, it's a problem. And it poses a very serious threat to the, what do you call it, the passengers. To the extent that I remember last week, I had to cancel that, take another route coming to Cape Town because really it was putting a serious threat there. So that my question on this one would be, are they leased? Are they purchased? What is the state of affairs with regard to BAE versus SAA? Thank you very much.
Thank you. I just want to ask the Minister whether he can elaborate a little bit more on what the Chief of Generation at Eskom said last week. He he argues that the nuclear power stations that will come to in operation in 2016-2017 will be a little bit late, not late, but the time frame before that, there will be a need for another basis power station to be built. And I assume that is another one over and above the contract that's already been allocated to Hitachi for the energy project. Can you just elaborate a little bit more? Will that be a coal power plant? And what is the planning? A little bit more about that. And what will it more or less generate to supplying the demand? Because you also argue that the demand might even be more than 40%, might be even more than 4% per annum. And that's why we need another basic power station before the nuclear stations come into operation. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I'll be quick, just a question. Because I don't know, Chair, but since Comrade Pololo has read the safety threat, I thought I want to check with the Minister, I've checked with Dr. Sean earlier, whether, because I know a plot is a problem in a generation plot, but whether a missing school is a safety threat to enter the flight, because last week I flew to Joburg and I landed once and found there's a missing school on the aircraft. So I took pictures and posted them on my website, and I'll also email it to the department. Luckily, I found that, well, maybe not lucky, but I only thought after I landed. So there wasn't any panic on the aircraft. But I have seen some other TV series things that one missing school can create problems. So that also related to my second question, whether these also from with the generation, are these related to the maintenance cost being decreased over time? And because I also heard that one of the reasons that Eskom was making profit was a lot of their maintenance job was outsourced or being cut, and as a result, over the past few years, the equipment and various items have decreased, and also their technical capacity.
I want to find out from your perspective. I mean, I hear what you're saying about cash inflation and the SAA and that those things should be known in terms of taking value. But is that the only difficulty with SAA, or are there other challenges? And in your view, what would those be? And what is being done about the and put it simply, is the solution to SAA's woes merely throwing money at the problem, or are there deeper, more should we say involved issues that require to be sorted out at SAA?
Thank you, Chair. Firstly, to the Honourable Galore, SAA Link is not owned by us. There's a passive, relatively passive holding SAA has, which allows for some of the co-branding. But SAA Link is a separate company. We have no effective control over it in any way whatsoever. It's a private sector company. So I'm unfamiliar with whether they've leased or purchased. My guess is they probably leased it. Those are very well-known aircraft. I'm not sure precisely what's happening there, but I mean, those are excellent aircraft. And it's interesting that Air Link are able to increase their size on that. There's a future relationship between Air Link Express and SAA. Once we've completed the transaction with SAA Express, obviously there's some merit in looking at what that should be. These are Air Link and Express are complementary in some ways. If you watch them closely, historically what happened was Air Link has got much smaller aircraft, below 50 I think, and then Express goes up to 70 seaters. So they designed to deal in slightly different niches of the market. But Airlink are certainly open to some discussion. We would be open to some discussion to see what the future would look like. But for the present, I just want to stress that these are not, we have no influence or control whatsoever over Airlink. Yes, on Eskom, we have come to the conclusion that it would be wiser to do another base load. And that's what I was referring to earlier, POS-TRAC and IPP. And that's to give us, it's more of another insurance policy that in the event of us being, well, two possibilities. We may be successful in saving energy, but the economy may hit 7%. In which event it would be better then to have another base load coming on stream around about 2012, just to give us an insurance policy. So we are moving in that direction. Whether it's coal or another base load would be up to the proposer. My guess is it's likely to be coal, because if we're looking for approximately 3,000 megawatts. So given South Africa's position experience, my guess is it's likely to be coal. But we will wait and see as the process unfolds what the proposals actually are. But it's from the experience we've had where a low reserve margin can deteriorate to the emergency situation we've had, clearly it makes sense to even if we have to overbuild in that period, it makes sense. And in addition, nuclear builds are complex, so we should also factor in that there may be project delays there. This is why we've gone now for another IPP for 3,000 megawatts. The process is happening now. I, you know, it's a bit unfair of you, Chris, to raise things like screws and bolts with me. I really know. I thought you were in my party, you know. But what I can say is I think it's always wise, and I thank you for taking a photo and bringing it to people's attention. I mean, I'm not sure what the situation was, but we welcome that. SAA's reputation for technical excellence is really very good, and we intend keeping it that way. And every effort to make sure that we do keep it that way. I think we've got, in our domestic passenger fleet, we've got two excellent aircraft, both proving the Boeings and the Airbus is proving to be very, very efficient, very good aircraft. So we've got a good fleet, very good fleet. But please, anything you see, draw our attention. As you've seen, I think SAA probably is very, very cautious. Any sign of a problem, and they delay the flight. So it's wise. On Eskom, Eskom's maintenance record is also excellent. It's a highly, highly rated utility. And it's worth looking at that. You know, these utilities get rated around the world. There's an annual competition where all the utilities get rated. And Eskom's always done very, very well. But nonetheless, what the board's done with our support, we've brought in international consultants to do an audit of the maintenance process. Were we doing everything right? Were there difficulties? What was happening? And that will be an important report for the board and for government to look at what happened. So, Eskom's got a practice which we're very supportive of, and also in terms of the regulatory environment. Any incident has to go through an audit process. And you've got a report on what happened, which is useful. So, I think that we're watching this very, very closely, and the international consultants should report to us relatively soon on what their findings are. They started some weeks back. With SAA, I want to stress, as we've said right at the beginning when we started the restructuring process, our approach is not to chuck money at the airline. It would be a fatal mistake. The restructuring of SAA is essentially to bring its cost structures down. You have to become more efficient in SAA. They have to reduce their cost structures. They've got to reconfigure a range of processes they've got to look at everything, and that was the so-called Seabury plan, which was a detailed exercise in reorganizing the business. So capitalization must be associated with an effective restructuring plan. And that was also Treasury's requirement, that you've got to show progress in your restructuring before you capitalize. So it would be, what we would do would be to capitalize a restructured SAA, not to recapitalize the old SAA. And there were certainly many problems in SAA in terms of its cost structure, some of its commercial practices that we have to redefine. And you'll recall that a key element of the restructuring was to say very clearly to SAA, we are not asking you to fly to every city in the world. You will fly to a limited number of cities, you will link to some of our key routes, and we're not expecting you to be a flag carrier that flies all over the world. You fly particular routes, these are the key corridors with our main trading and commercial and tourist partners, and then you put more emphasis on Africa, and you reduce your footprint in South Africa and allow Express and others to take over. So it's a realignment of the airline towards, as we loosely say, an African airline with international reach. And that's a process that's going reasonably well. But we have to hit rate of returns on assets that are comparable to some of our benchmark airlines. So that will begin to stabilize our capitalization. Now, to reach that rate of return on assets, you've got to improve your revenue performance, but you've got to really improve the revenue per seat, which means you've got to cut your costs per seat without taking away the sort of semi-premium position that SAA seems to want to compete in. We're not a low-cost airline, we're not a regional airline, we're a semi-premium type airline on the domestic routes. That's the basis of the strategy, and we can only capitalize if we see progress in that. And I must say we've seen some good progress in the year, but each year is tough. We've got to watch it closely. Thank you.
Second, third take, Mr. Wang, follow up. Mr. Gololo. Okay.
No, thank you, Chair. I think just maybe clarification from my side. You know, it's funny because it's funny when I'm still sitting here. It's not so funny the plane falls down. And that's why the main crux of my question earlier was to simply discussing about the budget. The maintenance budget that all these vehicles have been spending on the equipment and the skills and the stuff, has it been decreased over the years, and how is it reflected in our budget in terms of, because the great program that you see here, it's more on administration over the SOE, and not reflecting the actual budget in each of the SOE. And that's also what we're trying to raise in the Joint Budget Committee as well. We find it difficult to zoom into the SOE in terms of what the allocation are in each department. So in this instance, if the missing school is considered as a safety risk, why is the technical service never sounded before the aircraft took off? If it's not so much of a big risk, then obviously I might be worried for nothing. So that tells you that it's not really a safety risk. But I'm just worried that, given a good break without technical services, a machine screw of that size, I can see it from the window sitting outside on an aircraft wing. I think that's quite a serious concern. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Actually, I just want the Minister to maybe tell us as to what is the progress with regard to Mango? How does the balance sheet look like since inception?
I also want to, sorry,
Dr. Hanbeck, Dr. Hanbeck. Chairperson, thank you. I just want to add on what the Honourable Wong asked. It was the papers, I think, on Friday. There were delays on two SAA flights, one international flight from Oliver Tambo,
abroad, and the other one was also from Oliver Tambo down to Durban. Are you aware of that? Because the one that overseas flight was delayed for about 7 days to sleep over. And on the other case, people had to actually, once they're on the plane, they all had to evacuate the plane. They got off with their luggage into another plane without any reasons given to them. And people phoned me and they were quite upset about the fact that they were not informed why they had to leave the plane from Oliver Tambo down to Durban. I think that was on Friday evening, late afternoon evening. That brings me to the thing, and I know what you say, that pilots are very careful, but if maintenance has been done properly, should we expect things like that, that planes will be then delayed due to technical things?
You might want to just, with that, where that question also speak to a little bit about, you mentioned the challenges with the new Ports Act and the implementation. You might want to just expand on some of those challenges for so that we have some sense of what they actually say.
On specific issues, we show us the picture and we'll check exactly what the position is and give you a report back on it. I mean, I'm sure if they were ready to indicate exactly what the position was and what was happening. On maintenance budgets, these are, you can assess these to a reasonable degree in the financial statement. I'm not aware of any trend line of supply and maintenance. I think it would be a problem. There was. In Transnet, we had a bit of that. And if you recall it, last year there was quite a lot of attention paid to that. One of the complicating factors you've now got is that in terms of international financial reporting standards, some of the maintenance that's now done must be capitalized. So you may recall, I think it was last year's financial statement for Transnet, there was a significant capitalization of maintenance. I think it was something like 8 or 9 billion. So one can look at that, but certainly there's no intention, and we're not aware of a problem with the climate maintenance budget. In fact, as a result of Transnet's experience, we have indicated to all the SOEs that they must continuously review their maintenance programs and patterns. On Magna's balance sheet, we assess it at the end of this financial year, but it's been reasonably stable. But it would be wiser to take a close look at it at the end of this financial year. We're getting very, very high occupancy rates, and we have to have a look at what it will look like. But the best time to do it would be when we assess it at the end of this financial year. I'm not aware of particular flight delays, that sort of stuff. And we'd have to see what the issues are. I mean, if there was no reason given, tell us what the flight was, and we can try and find out from SAA what it was. But normally the captain would give a reason. Technically, may not specify the precise technical reason, but usually the captain would give a reason. So if we didn't, I don't know why. We'd have to check that. But I think that the evidence we have is that there's no major deterioration in flight departure as a result of maintenance. All airlines are going to have some maintenance problems, but then you're not going to fly an international flight if you've got any doubt about a maintenance issue. And that happens to all airlines. And we can certainly check that. I'm not aware of any major changes there. The Ports Act, the issue that arises is that the Act villages for NPA, the National Ports Authority, envisages two phases. One would be the corporatization of the NPA as a separate corporate division rather than just a division of Transnet. And the thinking behind this in that act is that if NPA is going to fulfill a landlord function, it should have an arm's length relationship from SA Ports Operations, another division of Transnet. And that process, the corporatization process, is required by the Act. There's a second optional phase, where the shareholder minister, minister of transport, minister of finance, after consultation, could make NPA a public company, which would be a very different situation. Now, the corporatization of the NPA is a matter we have to grapple with this year in one or other way. The concern that Transnet has raised all along in it, which was a serious concern in the period 2004-05, is that would alter the revenue streams and the asset base, the legal form of the assets within Transnet, and that could have an impact on what's called the loan covenant. Now, we have to explore that in some detail. Those are the kind of issues that we've got to grapple with this year. They're pretty technical issues around balance sheets, revenue streams, taxation issues, impact on the balance sheet. But the Act is pretty clear that it requires corporatization. And we would await also thereafter from the regulator quite an important bit of regulatory requirements, which is an essential framework for any form of concessioning or partnership concession, or any specific injunction to Transnet that we want you to do this or that. It has to be covered by frameworks. It's not unlike what you've got with the ECA situation, where the ministers, through regulation, can specify that the state can carry out certain strategic activities if it wants to. So that the regulators indicated that would be ready, I think, Andrew, next year, in November this year, they estimate. So this does have implications of a technical nature for us around the port of Kuka. We're continuing with the construction work, but what's the final state of Kuka requires some of these developments this year in the legal and regulatory environment to be clarified. But we can, I think it'll be worth at some point going through a more detailed presentation on the implications of the Act, what it's doing, what the regulatory environment is, what the possible impact could be on Transnet, which we're working on.
Thank you very much. Before you leave and before we adjourn for tea, that we've got about 15 minutes, I think you might want to take the opportunity to just talk to us broadly about some of your perspectives insofar as the Department itself is concerned. What are the areas of strength? And I think you've spoken to some of those. But from your perspective, what would you say are the biggest challenges, biggest weaknesses, and what would you, I know we're into the last census peak and you're looking at the intrinsic systems and operational mechanisms, but what are those weaknesses? What would you like to see happen differently in the department? And in terms of relationships between the department and employees, the board, and the management as well. Are there certain things there that can be passed and have relationship protocols developed that perhaps require to be done? Just broadly on the department itself, its role and its challenges.
The scope of concern, of course, is the high attrition rate in the department. So maybe it's going to be some of those. Well, I think that the department, I'm very pleased that they've settled down, and I think that my view is that our business plans, and that for the last 3 years, have been very consistent with much greater clarity of direction, purpose, and programs that we're doing. So I do think that we've settled down very well. The challenge facing this department is an interesting one, and that is that nothing's very static for very long. You've got continuous changes and new challenges, and it's very much, as I said at the beginning, it's a department that acts like a shareholder. So the vagaries or the vicissitudes of what happens in the economy immediately impact on the SOE, and you immediately have to respond. So this is not kind of a nice, easy, relaxing administrative department where you just sit and watch what's happening. You're always engaging. I think a very big challenge has been that the actual contractual negotiations around a pebble bed or around a Eskom IPP or around a broadband infraco or around creating subsidiaries in Danel, these are the kind of things that are dealt with major merchant banks and investment banks. These are not small contracts, not tiny little things. So I've been very pleased that a relatively young department has developed very rapidly the skills and the capacity to deal with these complexities. Clearly we have to deal with advisors and elsewhere, but it's a real challenge. And that comes to the next challenge. One thing that's not often appreciated, to the best of my knowledge, which I think that we use, the only department which is not an actual department. It was set up as an office of government, and all of our people are essentially contract workers, by and large, the key people. Now there's some merits to that, but it's also some difficulty, because it means that I think what you find in practice is you often find that people who expected a kind of very normal public service life suddenly find an extremely hectic life that is much closer to an investment bank or a merchant bank. So our teams tend to work like a transaction team of a merchant bank. And I think very some people are uncomfortable with that, and because of the contract issue, they just don't renew or they resign. But secondly, another reality is that the amount of experience you get in DPE equips you fantastically for the private sector. I mean, this must be, in my personal view, probably the best training ground you could find for the commercial world. So I think we must inevitably expect a turnover rate. I'm not at all uncomfortable with the rate. I think it's fine. Bearing in mind the nature of the work, bearing in mind that sometimes you actually want to contract skills in for a short time. And we use these contractee methods quite heavily. If you're dealing with the immense complexities of forming infracodes, in the private sector, people dealing with that earn salaries, that massive salaries. So we have to contract in specific specialists. So I think that I'm very, very pleased with DG and the team, the way they've handled that. I think that the big achievement is the setting of the various teams, the transport team, energy team, manufacturing team, setting that down well. We've improved our communication. There's some areas that we still have to work on a little bit, to turn out. I think in communication we could probably still do a bit more, but that's the challenges are immense. Not a weakness, it's an opportunity that we're working on. And we've developed a much stronger communications team. I think we take it more seriously now. I think it's doing really well and starting to grow. As the CFO and CROs will report, I personally experienced in the department very real improvements in our system. Clearly our objective is to once again get an unqualified audit. I mean, that's a major achievement. I think that's a tremendous good star, gold star for the finance division. We need to keep that moving. What can we do differently? For the moment, not much that I can think of. I think we're always striving to improve some of the areas and do better. I think that the systems I'm comfortable are in place. A challenge this year is that we must settle all those systems down and make sure that we document them accurately and leave them for the next administration, for the political administration. The operational systems would stay the same. With the SOEs, I think that the relationship is essentially good, taking into account an inherent tension. And I think that we've managed to regulate that tension and just aggregate it into clear areas. So the risk forum, the financial officers forum, the company secretary forum of the FSS has very much improved the relationship that we have. We still hit a few problems here and there. Sometimes quarterly reports are a bit late. Sometimes it's us and not processing it fast enough. But by and large, I think that the relationship with the SOEs has really improved, and our objective is to make it a regularized process, that we operate on known information that must be given to us, known procedures, known protocols around how we do things. And I think we've made great progress in that. For us to have been able to engage with both Eskom and the DME during this emergency without some major flare-up of tension, I think has been a great testimony to the hard work and patience of the DG Energy team and all others. The movement of Advocate Kutsia to our Chief Investment Officer, I think it also helped us, because it's concentrated the more transactional dimensions in a single place, and that team is really gelling nicely, I think, with the other team in the division. So, all in all, doing well. There are one or two very, very, generally I think we're very strong. We're performance is not up to scratch. We would take the necessary actions. And I think we've been able to take the necessary actions for weak performers in a manner that's gone well rather than being disruptive. But I'm very personally pleased with the department and the support I get. And the spirit in the department is a lot of energy, a lot of activity, and not too many bitter clashes and crises. The crises clear up and settle very quickly, because the DG is a very, very settled person. Usually needed to precipitate the crisis and have to do it.
Get into some of the details of the human resources class and the other but we should have two answers that worked today. Thank you very much. I do know that you have to do that. You're of course welcome to pop in at any stage over the next days. No doubt there'll be more coming out of those sessions. But you are invited to join us for tea, which I am told is outside and so warm, which is a treat in itself. Then we adjourn for about 10 minutes for tea, and then tea breaks continue immediately thereafter. It's now, according to my watch, it's
10:05.
And I'm going to start whether you're inside or outside.
We covered the three areas of mining regulation, which remain fundamentally unchanged. There is refinement that we saw in the case around this much greater, better focus and better understanding on our side. Some of the key achievements and challenges, and then priority areas and planned activities. In the planned activities, I will broadly what we plan to do, and the individual UGs will do in greater detail what things we plan to do ourselves. The presentation for the next 2 days covers the work that we do directly overseas to the federal legislature. The mandate of the DPE remains one of ensuring that there's alignment between the business strategies of the SOE, as well as the sector department performance and the regulatory authorities. This has improved significantly. In the early years, the question of what's the role of the shareholder relative to a policy department was a little bit nebulous and caused a significant amount of tension between the two departments. But I think without fear of contradiction, in virtually all the areas that we work, in our relations with the policy department are actually excellent. And when a matter arises which causes you concern, there is one form of direct and get direct response. And in many areas we work jointly. In the employees that report to the department, we've included a shared spread, which is a listed forum, in the sense that it's only from the financial year or April 9 that it takes refuge and starts reporting directly to us. but as part of the arrangement that we had with Translate in the year prior to the movement of SAA for ourselves, we've been having a few oversight responsibility basis over SAA, over SAA. So those are the nine SAEs. In the case of the pivoted modular reactor, we will, when the team talks about it, and hopefully when the governance unit, legal and governance, speak to that issue as well. One of the things, in finalizing the shareholders' agreement, we deal with the issue of whether we would have to put in legislation to establish a new state owned enterprise or we avoid it. If the state owns less than 51% of the company, there is a compulsion because it's not a major state owned, it's not a majority state owned. There would be other owners and substitutes in the company. We're hoping that by the end of March we would have been able to sign the shareholders agreement if there's a small delay going into the following year, into the following financial year. One of the reasons when we came to the legislation for the year, we have not included exceptional legislation for the first model reactor. Our vision remains one of ensuring that the SOEs are efficiently managed and that they do meet domestic and international industry operational benchmarks. It has been an area where in most of the SOEs and the forecast have signed contracts. We're now at the point where for performance we are beyond just financial targets, but we're actually now covering operational areas as well. One or two still remains a contentious area, but maybe I think we are making inroads in as far as that's concerned, because the big issue was about if they are going to be capitalistic in the economy, they then have to be also operationally efficient as well. We've also, the whole question of what is the appropriate distribution of responsibilities between the private and the public sector in the sector in which the SOE plays remains a key issue of concern for us going forward. And in most of the SOEs, we think we've done quite good work in defining the state of the state to the areas where it's either natural monopoly or there's a market failure or the cost of the investment is so high that you actually can't afford such many players as inefficient, but too many players investing directly in those areas. So I think we've made quite significant inroads in those sharpening of those focuses in those areas of SOEs that we have responsibility for. In the case of Transnet, before the end of this financial year, we are going to go to Cabinet with the BOE program, with their port and rail master plan, and also the associated branch line strategy. Finalization of that will create, for the first time, the possibility to go out into the public sector, to the private sector, or to the market in any case, the places where private sector rail operations can start coming into the system as well. The really good progress would be towards the end of this. The other objective, I've put the English reserve margin simply because that's the word that everybody's going to understand. In electricity, for choice there are international standards of what should be a reserve margin that you have in excess energy that's available for growth, should you have faster growth. In the case of electricity, often in the argumentation is also around enabling maintenance of the system as well. But some sense of excess capacity in infrastructure investment is crucial if you're going to have an economy which is not bottlenecked each time and is cheap hydro by the availability of infrastructure. In the case of the transport system, we have to work on what would that benchmark be, of what's the excess of capacity that we should have. The issue about why you have to stress about what's the amount is that it's not free. There's a cost to having spent capacity invariably, and it's to find that it's not the cost and the benefits that we need to work on. In the case of electricity, fortunately, the regulator and the department responsible have set the benchmark of the fee to 90%, and that's what we will be having income to the program achieving. And then the last area, which remains an important area, and is an area of quite a lot of joint work with the Department of Trade and Industry and its supporting institutions, is the area of leveraging the investment programs of the SOE so that there's benefit to the South African economy, but also African economies as well, with the key issue here being sustainability. The history of South Africa is littered with many sectors that we started, and we suddenly have started the BOE program and the investment program of the state and the sector companies as well. So what we've been at great pains to do is to ensure that when we create an opportunity for private sector for South African companies, we are clear of the fact that there's sustainability behind it. And our sustainability indicators really too. Do we have a long-term full program or initial program for the SME possible? And secondly, the areas that we ever target for South African procurement would be the areas where there is a competitive advantage in South Africa and therefore the possibility of export benefits from South Africa. Mission is really to ensure that all the SMEs have got a clear mandate. What we've learned over the last couple of years is that clarity of mandate enables the company and the board to also have clarity of expectations from the shareholder. In the Shareholder Management Act, this is one of the areas that we actually also wanted to have clear procedures under which all shareholder representatives, because in the Shareholder Management Act, we go beyond just the responsibilities that we have as PPE, but to create, attempt to create a system of governance that will cover all shareholder departments when in respect of stakeholder companies, in particular the trading enterprises. In the understanding that many of the guidelines that we will put out will have application also for the smaller stakeholder enterprises, is that they must be clearly communicated in written form at particular intervals to the board, the mandate of HRA. Also, in terms of providing consistent and strategic performance management, this week we had our second board meeting of the Department of Public Enterprises, where for the second time and this only happens because we have created the position of a chief investment and portfolio management position, where we now go through all of the SOEs and we compare performance and collate what our portfolio is looking like, the improvement of performance, what are the risks that we face in the portfolio going forward. This is something that we plan to do on a consistent basis. We've always on a quarterly basis done performance reviews of all of the SOEs on the back of the reports that they give us on a quarterly basis. But now we started collating the whole portfolio together and are starting to show comparisons in performance. We have an ambition, and this is an ambition in this year, to start writing in pretty much the same way as the analyst market would do our assessments of an SOE and some reduction towards the wholesale kind of decisions on the SOE, so that we're able to provide assistance to particularly board members. Because we have a lot more time to review the SOEs than board members would invariably have, by virtue of the fact that they are under four board meetings and they also sit on one or two committee meetings to get details of the company. It's an addition at this stage, and hopefully by the end of the year we will have been able to get that defined, because through the minister. Because also, there's a risk attached to this. Our analysis is going to be absolutely spot on for us to cause undue stress to the organization. But it also helps board members to be able to ask the clear questions and also to have a sense of which data we worry about, so that they can start making it help with their oversight and their management of the company as well. And then also this issue of governance and ensuring that there isn't a confusion of communication is something that we've always been very cautious about. So one of the things that we did indicate this, I think, last year, was moving towards with transactions guidelines, the decisions of the company are communicated to us now, including a board resolution, which ensures that all decisions are appropriately approved by all of the necessary structures in the organization. And resolving matters like materiality and significant frameworks across the SMEs, so that there's clarity around what decisions are bring to the shareholder and what decisions they would make under normal circumstances, and just report back to us on what changes are being done. Elements of DPE's core mandate collaborating in cases are around the oversight of the SOE performance, which particularly relates to financial and operational indicators. Now, we've always said every single, and we make sure, and I think the minister actually went back to that today, we always ensure that the SOEs understand that in the event that they're in a sector where there is a BEE code, they are expected to comply with the BEE code in totality, with the one exception, and that is of equity. So when they report to us, they have to cover how they're doing in terms of employment equity, how they're doing in terms of procurement by in the event they find that themselves in a sector where there isn't the code, they then have to comply with the guidelines of the Department of Trade and Industry. In the oversight of the disposal of non-core assets by SOEs, I think a wise decision to get the department out of direct place, because it meant that we are able to actually play a much more effective oversight responsibility, and also in terms of necessity for an appeal, because we are not players in the process. It's possible to use us as a direct appeal if there are any concerns. To be honest, in the last 2 or 3 years, we've never had a complaint about the transaction which has gone standing, or anyone having complaints about the process that was followed in the transaction. What we, however, have made sure is that the employees are undertaking the disposals in line with the approvals that they would have received from the minister. And the approvals often range between decisions where we say you maximize the benefits, the financial benefits, you have an industry effect, or you ensure that there's BEE, or you then ensure that the preferred winners must be a syndicate of property, be from the locality where the property is going to be located, as far as you possibly can get that. The leverage of employee assets for the benefit of the South African economy, and this would tie up quite tightly with the the work that we've done in Infocom. At this particular junction, we're not doing too much else other than close on that transaction. And then the other stuff is around the procurement, ensuring that the procurement of the federal enterprise does maximize investment opportunities for South African manufacturing. On the leveraging by the state-owned enterprise of state-owned assets, employee assets, I think Andy talked a little bit to it, but it's work that will come back during the course of the work of the year, around the role of employee technical in the aviation space going forward, and also just ensuring that that remains a strong company, because it's quite an interesting, if strong and properly capitalized, has the possibility of growing significantly the services industry around maintenance, aviation, and everything like that going forward, which are some of the high value added sectors, some of the sectors that we'd like to continue growing in South Africa. Just briefly, in terms of performance of the SOEs, the costs that we have responsibility for in the last year, we have reported audited financial figures for last year, and that's just a correct procedure. We can't give you numbers which have not been audited. As the only SOE that actually issues half-yearly results, which are audited in Transnet, we decided to stay with the annual results for all of the other SOEs. The current case of the Redco remains a one-term situation, and they, despite there being some improvements, there's improvements simply because the operations are now in care and maintenance, basically, and so we're having the bare minimum expenditure taking place in the company. But in as far as the movement of the assets, the agricultural assets off the balance sheet and towards the community, that work, there's good progress that's been made in that area. This year, it's really going to be about ensuring that we move further, fast-track the process of the TSJD, the work of the TSJD, to ensure that we have a proper business plan so that we can affect the proper capitalization of the company. But, I think it's doing as best as we can at this particular moment. We've benefited a bit from the devaluation of diamonds in this current financial year, and that you'll see in the annual financial statements when they come out. In the case of Bolton Infocom, really it's been an interesting process. We've not gotten any invoices, and probably for a while we will not, other than invoice just one company because of the facility arrangements that we have until we are licensed with NAILCA. But we have provisioned all of the single route connectivity services to 20 core backbone and regional expansion sites. CETA went live on the 18th of January this year. So really good progress. And as far as the work on the business plan for the West Coast cable progress really fast, we've already got an MOU which has gone through the core partners that we are approaching for participating in the cable. and we should be able to hear from them the impact of timing of this for the MOU the 29th of February. By first week, I think, of April, we have to put down the 10% of the money so that the cable can begin to be constructed. And the intention of this project is to make the deadline of 2020. Some concerns that we're watching and that we are in discussion with DOC is around the Ukumnet cable so that we don't see each other out of the market going forward. But, you know, progress is being made as far as that's concerned as well. So now, much better this year, and even in the last financial year, you'll see that in terms of performance, it improved significantly. We were still having issues around water cover. Interim figures that we've received thus far indicate a much, much, much improved water cover ratio compared to last year. By the end of this year, we've got to move, this financial year, we've got to move to close on the end state, which is an indication then of what are the final costs, what we will be exiting, and what we remain in, given the same sector strategy that was approved, that was presented to cabinet, as well as the areas that DOD has indicated as strategic for states, for the state to continue to have a leading role going forward. ESCOM, being the leader, I suppose, in terms of performance, it's generally been doing quite well. The big concern that we've had really is the operating costs, driven by and large by the cost of primary energy. We've fortunately been able to reach agreements with the regulator that they will look at passing through the price the cost of primary energy. You'll know that for some time, ESCOM still has some derivative instruments. They remain on one, because in good times the company's profits will shoot up today, and in bad times it can actually have quite significant negative effects on the company. As in the case of the other SOEs, it's an area where we now no longer have any derivative type contract. But there are those that we stuck with until the end of the period of the contract, because the cost of unwinding, at least when we last assessed it, was a bit too high for an unwind, but which means that it does create real volatility for returns for the of the enterprise. And as far as there are those concerns, they are on track to deliver 1,105 megawatts into the system in 2008, so some good news and as far as that's concerned. I imagine that there was a presentation that was made on the recovery program, but it would be worthwhile to have a presentation by the department and the portfolio committee on the supply side, because it's in the supply side where what ESCOM is doing has a direct impact on the recovery program. What all we are doing and what else we've added to the system in order to ensure that we have additional megawatts also coming into the system of domestic urgency. With regard to the Pimgate modular reactor, in the last financial year, we've contributed 2.1 billion rand to the company. That includes the 2.9 million in that. There's an M at the end. $219 million that has been paid back into the system. But otherwise, in terms of some real progress, if you recall last year there was a workshop audit that was issued by the nuclear regulator that was listed on the 22nd of December. What that meant is that some of the manufacturers can now continue on the project. We are still to assess the impact that delay would have caused to the ability of Nibblebit to meet the deadline for the demonstrated plan to be on stream. The accelerator cooling facility that SDF, that's what it stands for, the license was received on the 17th of January. So pretty much most of the licensing conditions that were necessary for PDMR have been fulfilled. In the helium test facility, we've been able to achieve 100,000 helium, as you know, is a particularly difficult substance gas to deal with. And so one of the core areas of research that you need to get closure on before you can start generating electricity is how you handle learning African and reading the context together. In the case of Glasgow, also its performance much better. We've indicated that if you compare it to the previous period, but the previous period is a shorter period because of the change in the reporting period from June to March to April to March of each financial year. However, one area that will be through this financial year coming is the issue of the fines. Because if you recall what the fines do, they increase the available so long, and the following year they cause ample tensions because suddenly there's a drying up of available stock in the market. So just being able to communicate that well to the industry so that people don't assume that there's suddenly excess supply when they actually just as a result of the fines that there's excess supply. As the minister indicated, work around the SACOL transaction progresses, but one area that we are going to have to concentrate a lot more effort on this year is resolving the issue of the land claims before we can generally get to closure. Because the land claims issue affects what the length of the leases that we would be able to sign with any procurer of the right to harvest, effectively, which is what we do in the Senate. In the case of if the A, the loss is not here, we are watching their performance relative to the Seagri turnaround strategy. And as far as they implemented the retrenchment process last year that they had required to undertake, the funding that they would have received from us was for assisting with their retrenchment exercise. By the end of this year, the end of this financial year, '07-'08, the 1.3 million, the 1.3 billion guarantee needs to be rolled over. And at that point, we should then be able to review again how far this come and what are the next steps in terms of moving it towards greater financial sustainability. I think in the course of the year, even at the autumn school, one of the things that we can indicate is that SAS gearing, when you take also the off-balance sheet items, is horrendous, it's extremely high. But it remains a core area of focus to ensure that the CBD turnaround strategy is implemented effectively and that the targets are being achieved. And we hold regular meetings with SAS where they indicate performance on a monthly basis. It is really satisfactory. We anticipate that they'll meet their profit targets. Their regional operations are expanding somewhat, and also one of the core areas that we're worried about and will be watching is the commercial relationships that exist between SAM and Sixpack. That we must be one which has optimal outcomes, not only for the airlines, but also for the South African economy as well.
Any questions?
In the case of Transnet, really most of their financial indicators have been achieved. There have been some improvements in the freight flow. But in their case, the really, as the minister had indicated, a core area that we're going to deal with this year is Kuka. We don't have a moment to delay that. The Act has been promulgated, the NPAF has been promulgated, and so what we'll be hoping to do is to do a review of the covenants that they have, what is the general risk, and also how we ensure that there's compliance to requirements of the law stated in the NPA, but also at the same time not causing undue instability around Transnet, given the fact that it still has to go into the financial market to raise capital. So we remain quite concerned about the tariff increases that we've been reading about in the press, because one of the core issues around having an efficient Transnet as well, though, has got to be around a Transnet that charges tariffs that actually do ensure that the most efficient mode of transport is used. And we worry about the fact that there continues to be a growth of traffic on the road. But it's an area of focus, and also the turnaround strategy for rail operations is an area that we'll be looking at quite closely with you. We anticipate that with the branch line strategy coming in and a lot more private operators being able to function on the branch line, you should start to see an increase in capacity in all of these and in the branch lines, which are located in economic hubs, that there should be an increase in volume that operates in those areas. But it's something that we'll be watching for the year. In the case of the competitive supply development program, we had a project last year where we worked with ESCOM and Transnet to look at their complete fuel sourcing to see whether on the back of their fuel sourcing could we achieve some sort of a buying power with respect to suppliers domestically. One of the things that we found is that there's sometimes quite serious differences between what Transnet would be requiring and what ESCOM would be requiring. And so in the ability to genuinely get economies of scale somewhat limited. However, what we've done is made the studies available to both organizations to see if they could still eke out some benefits out of a little bit more coordination across the board. We've held several procurement capacity training sessions with the federal enterprises, we've done with the general procurement section, and we've also done it with the capital project. And this capacity building program was really tied with the competitive supply development program, because by its nature, the competitive supply development program requires much more strategic procurement and not procurement that's based on just one of items, but developing a long-term strategic relationship with your suppliers. All of the employees, they have a deadline at the end of this financial year to deliver all of their supply development program, which would then be used as initially GPI has to approve these. They then used to negotiate to be discussed with the whole industry and particularly manufacturers in the various areas, so that manufacturers then start having a sense of what the investment program of the employee looks like going forward. And then they can invest and plan to be suppliers to that program. We work quite closely with IDC on this program as well. We have established and formalized the relationship with UNIDO, which is the agency that we are using to do supply benchmarking in South Africa, and also it will do supply benchmarking in the particularly starting with SADC and any other particular country that makes sense. And the benchmarking exercise is particularly useful in that it creates a database of suppliers, of companies that can be potential suppliers to the same or enterprises in South Africa, as well as within the region, that's one. Secondly, as well, for the companies, they give them an indication of what it is that they have to do to be able to qualify as suppliers to the same or enterprise. So it, in a sense, leaves behind some sort of strategic path that the company would have to follow for us to be able to achieve growth by virtue of the fact that they would be suppliers to such a supplier. The strategies, the South African Power Project strategy board strategy was presented to cabinet recently, and what they're now doing is undergoing is the process of negotiating and discussing with the various boards of the state-owned enterprises which are directly affected by this project. And then also we'll start talking a lot more broadly to industries who have to gear up for the investment programs and cashes not just nuclear, but also to the whole power sector going forward. In terms of EIA support, we are working closely and have worked quite well with these in the last year in developing a framework for the treatment of strategically important developments. And this one is to ensure that when you have a project of board entry into the strategy, there's clarity around what process to follow, and there is a notification process to each around projects. We've also helped to co-fund with the employees some of the lead specialists who would help to fast-track on their part the EIA. Other areas of performance, we had to revise the EE guidelines for the disposal of property so that there was alignment with the CCI code. We've developed a self-assessment toolkit, which is now under the CE website. The last leg is to get agreement from the state and enterprises that their suppliers can use the substitutes in toolkits. And this was an attempt to reduce a transaction cost with SOEs that arises from the fact that you have to first have your BE incentive accredited, and the cost range from the income is 200,000 and 100,000. If the SOEs agree to the substitutes in toolkits, it means that you would be able to develop the system for the purposes of supplying to central enterprise. You wouldn't need to necessarily have an additional outlay unless you could do that for anyone else. But we, in the next financial year, we must get closure on this. The moratorium on the sale of non-core properties by all of the SOEs has been lifted, and all that's left behind are the properties which were large pieces, which we felt had possibilities for having a broader developmental effect if there was a much more coordinated plan of what those pieces of property would be used for. And in the case of Rosherwood, which is a property that was owned by ECHO, the spatial studies have now been completed, and this will be presented and presented for review, and hopefully we'll move towards the implementation of the plan. On the skill side, we've worked with CIPSA, and basically we work with ECHO to collate all the requirements of artisans that they receive the financial support. What we also have done is establish a cross-cutting artisan training initiative. In the latter part of last year, we applied to the Department of Labor to establish a public enterprise employment and skills development agency. They called instance in the Department of Labor. In fact, I think last week there was on Monday there was an audit of the DPE to see if DPE would be able to have the capacity to administer an ESA. And our intention is not necessarily to have DPE, but to get people to appoint a couple of people to run with the ESA. And by and large, this is around just ensuring that we get funding from the teachers for SEC college graduates who would be trained to be on behalf of both the SOEs and also the suppliers. Of the employees, and so that all of the graduates would be able to get recognized trade certificates. By the end of this financial year, we shall hear from the Department of Labor whether we'll be able to get this. Our first major project is going to be around coordinating new skills across the industry, both in the employees but also in the nuclear manufacturing industry in the country. On the legislative side, last year we were finalized the budget the Pension Fund Amendment Act. Some issues are starting to arise around that, but to their questions, I think the Pension Fund and I should be able to deal with them. Also, FAA, both the Interpol and FAA, both were processed and promulgated. We've been collaborating quite closely with the Department of Communications, and by the end of the year, the electronic communications act also, the calendar year has been promulgated as well. We've been working quite closely with DOE, DPLG, and the National Treasury on the EDI restructuring, and at the time there was a vote which is now on hold, pending a final decision of whether the constitutional amendment that is selected in order to implement the race strategy. And the rest of settlement was also completed. Other key achievements relate to the collaboration that we've had with the Department of Defense, Trade and Industry, and Science and Technology in developing a sector strategy for the defense industry. And basically, this has created a roadmap of all of this around the consolidation of the industry, the establishment of the defense evaluation and research related institutions, which will report to the Department of DOD, but also work with the border agency as well as ensuring that the procurement policy does have built-in and actual back tools for us and suppliers. Revised bill program for ESCOM has been submitted to cabinet in the last year. Post and rail master plans are drafted, and this is in the case before the close of the financial year, we will have to post those to cabinet. And then the investment dashboard has been expanded significantly to cover a broader range of areas and not just the build program of the SOEs. And their procurement training in the, for the competitive supply development program has been rolled out. One of the risks that we worried about in the coming financial year that was that arises from this ending financial year that's ending is we're watching quite closely the development around the nuclear policy because its promulgation and therefore the implementation of its key recommendations is critical for the ESCOM build program, especially as a large part of the build program going into the future is going to be nuclear. And as you know, nuclear regulation and nuclear approvals take quite a long time. And so it is quite crucial that there's settlements around the nuclear policy and then also the implementation plans that affect themselves to that is quite crucial for us. We are, however, also undertaking a review of maintenance factors across all of the SOE that support for us to ensure that all of the risks are clear for us. And most importantly, that they stay to the boards and to management as well, and that we are actually having effective mitigation strategies in place. We'll also be looking at balancing the risk of weak SOE balance sheets against the need for very large investment programs going forward, finding strategies on how you could strengthen and also looking for opportunities in which private sector participants can get both on board in some of these areas. The other area where we're working quite strongly and immediately in the case of electricity, but also with the transport, is ensuring that the tariffs are cost reflective. Because whenever tariffs are not cost reflective, you find yourself in a situation where there's inefficient utilization. And so you have sudden very high jumps in demand, which have no direct correlation with growth, but rather reflect the fact that the input is too cheap for people to really ensure that they are optimizing and are being efficient. But at the same time, we have to look at cost-effective tariffs and balance that against inflationary effects and also the impact on the food. So that remains quite an important area that we have to look at in the coming year. And then also the question of fuel scarcity and the ability of suppliers to meet the SOE build program is going to be an area that we will be watching quite closely. Incidentally, the personal fuels rose, I suppose, quite sharply when we were having a meeting with the diesel manufacturers and so the water diesel manufacturers. This was one of the key interventions that we had to make in the residential side to reduce electricity consumption by residential is to replace diesel with solar water heaters or have adapted diesel which use a lot more solar energy and then as little electricity as possible. One of the key issues which we initially going into that meeting thought was going to be a constraint was the supply, the availability of solar water heaters and the rest of the land. The industry was quite firm in saying that you can import, that you can build, there's possibility to expand manufacturing capacity, but also there's also the possibility to convert an existing heater into solar water heater. But the core area that is what going to be a real constraint that we have to deal with is skills capacity. So it is this issue of skills, and I think in terms of timing, having the ESA available on time would mean that we are able to, even as the department, to use the ESA to run a lot faster in creating some of the skills and not waiting for, and not having to deal with the fact that in the end, an ESA has to optimize the skills. But you do, though, have somebody who's going to have to training in advance of demand sometimes. The next part of the presentation just talks a lot more, you know, this is our structure, and then we'll talk very briefly, and the leadership will talk in detail around what we're going to do. This is the structure that we've had. The one, I suppose, change that we've made is that we have put in a special advisor. We are using a special advisor post of the minister. We've basically moved Lee Tamponini into that position as advisor. He is looking after a couple of things, one of them being our interactions with unions. We've had interactions in the last 2 or so years with unions and federations around the turnaround plans for the SOEs and making sure that we are communicating those and having a sense of what may be big labor issues that you must watch across the board with employees, getting in mind that most all labor negotiation and management issues are responsibility of the organization. And also making sure that in as far as projects like the Palestinian Power Project would require an extensive amount of coordination are effectively communicated and that we are covering all the bases in that area. And then the last area which we hope Lisa's going to spend a lot more time and is energy on is in starting to codify all of the information that we now have in the various pieces which is used in the summit for to put together some sort of a book, which is there's one proposal that we've got on the table is to put together all of that information into some sort of a trainer of one sort so that some of the universities would be able to use those directly for specialist training in the area. But one of the big problems that we've had at CPE is that whenever you invariably recruit people, you don't find people who come to the place of being offered on understanding how a company would value in a particular sector. On the one hand, also being able to understand what are the policy influences that you have to deal with. So being able to get a lot more training that comes out with people in understanding that at the discipline would make life a lot easier. In fact, some of our recruitment problems might sort of like be significantly minimized. But that basically the main structure then of the EU. We've spoken about the chief executive and portfolio manager, very useful in sort of like getting a portfolio overview of the whole of the DPE, focused in particular on the enterprises, and then also helping to coordinate the big transactions, which are at the holding companies often, or the company that they own 100%, and not the subsidiary transactions that they employ the brand and sadly, we'll do a bit more of a presentation on our budget, but this is just a reflection of our numbers for the year. Over the entire period, our service was decreased by about 59.1%. That's from the 4.6 billion that we would have had in 2008 to 315 million in 2011. Transfers to the SOEs remained high for the first 2 years of the entire period. They combined for the 3 years about 4.9 billion rand. Of this, 3.5 billion is going to be allocated to CDMR in two tranches. The joint fund facility also received a significant boost from 14.4 million in 2008 to 27 million in 2011. But this does reflect work on the continent, the Africa project. And also for the power project, we've had to co-pay for between ourselves and Eskom, and that wasn't any good cheap work. The next slide gives the essence of the date, the period, is the same period, the first column is 708, the second column is 089, third 910, and the last column is 1011. It's just a breakdown of some of the numbers, but then we've also going to go again, so we'll touch on details around our budget for the year. But growth and getting to a point where there is a decline through much more smaller budgets, which is focused on the department. This is a summary of the transfer payments for this year, for the next 3 years, to the SOEs. Alexo will be seeing 260 million rand over 3 years. That includes the transfers that will have to come from the department to the department. PBMR, 3.5 billion that have been included. In this year coming, it's expected 585 million, and that basically is around the coalition to get closed on the transaction. Andrew will talk a little probably around what the 585 million land is for. On broadband infopo, we get 727 over the 3 year period, since that provided as indicated. And then in the case of SAA, there's nothing that we've requested yet, but we will be finalizing and having discussions with Treasury around just the funding of the Senate strategy for SAA. And in the case of Senau, we have received no additional funding for the remaining 3 years. We wouldn't raise the risk attached to no funding, but the agreement that we now have is that we do a final an in-state presentation of what the land looks like, and then at that point, we would then go back to cabinet. There's a team which is made up of National Treasury, COD, and ourselves, which is the financial support. To get to the DPED debt, we have got 162 calls, 143 approved, and we've got 19 vacancies. There's a breakdown by position. At the level 13 to 15, which is very upwards, we have 12 vacancies. In the last, from last year, April to date, it's not the end of the year, we've had 20 appointments and have quite a lot of positions which have been advertised and others which are interviewed in the pipeline. In certain instances, unfortunately, we may make offers to people and they get better offers elsewhere, so we do people. And then we've had, on the termination side, about 21 for the previous under question. 11 of them were resignations, one with contract expiry, and 9 were transfers. The aggregate data in the previous financial year, our turnover, our vacancy rate was 10.8%. In the current financial year, it's 11.7%, a slight increase. And the turnover rate in the previous year was 15.9%, now it's increased to 13%. This has been an area that we've kept quite a lot of push on to make sure that we have a reduction as much as possible on turnover, but bear in mind that people will be. If this puts together some an indication of the vacancies that we have, some of them, the number of days that they stay vacant. For example, if you look at the aviation and rail sector sector, it covers what they, we've advertised the position probably 2 or 3 times, and at each and every single time we've either changed the people when people were interested. At the last minute, they move on and they take other jobs. And so now we are trying to get hunting. The real issue here is that you get to a point where you are unable to find people at the salaries that you have. And invariably, if you then have a piece of work that's required, you either then outsource or try to speak to them, especially for a short period of time, in which time and into the department or so on. The business analyst position is a post that we've put on hold for a period, and I'm not sure it's still on hold.
No.
It is
still on hold.
We'll make fun, and the decision for the on hold was really rather an issue of what would the best utilization of that position. Do we keep it in line or do we leave it in as an ICT? Because that's really almost, it's the interface between IT and business process. Where that post will get off. It's actually quite an important post in the end because it ties up with the work that we're doing around codifying every process that's in DPE and making sure that there are procedures, there are processes available for whenever you appoint a new person. And I suppose that's something that we need as a legacy for new management coming into the department. The UG Energy post is a recent creation by virtue of the fact that we've moved Lisa to the position of acting of a special advisor to the minister. So Chris Boogie is acting as the DDG for that, and it will be assigned soon. The director of management, 480 days later, is a reflection of the difficulty of getting those people into institutions, get a job, get a pay in the private sector, and even in the state-owned enterprises. The DDG legal governance and risk was introduced. We held the interview on the 21st of January, and we're now just waiting to go through the cabinet process for finalization of the process. At this point, Ashton figured if he's acting as the DG for that year. So this is just to give you a sense of some of the challenges that you have in trying to get these posts. You do advertise, I mean, that is taken us 390 days to try and find the economist. Is also a reflection of this. Sometimes the supply situation that you have. We have found somebody, we offered them, and they got time to offer it, and so we didn't get them off in the end. We have stayed with the fairly aggressive incentive program. Last year we had 26 interns. In this financial year we have 22. There's some breakdown of the areas of the organisation that they locate themselves. A lot of them actually have been able to secure jobs in the last year when some time delayed to the SOEs, and some of them were able to get a job in some of the SOEs. A couple of them were jobs within the DTE. So really, on average, this is a program that is working quite well, and it's put quite a lot of energy to ensure that by the time the interns leave the department, they've been properly trained and actually are able to get alternative jobs. Some of the priority areas plan for you. In the area of administration, this would cover the ministry, finance, HR, corporate services, and digital strategy, communications, and my office. The chief investment and portfolio management is located within the DG's office as well. Basically, our priority is really for Oriental Marriage, which is staying on process of automation, our core focus on training and development. It's very big. It's been worth a while on the training and development side. We now have a standardized program which has indicated the core basic skills that people who work in DG should have, from the analysis skills right through to support staff in new phones, receptions and things like that. The performance management of staff remains the area that we watch. We always make sure that we have a system which is as objective as you can get it, and also as equitable as you can. If you can imagine, one of the things when ministry residents like strike me, we're so used to working in a previously tense, pressured environment. And the problem is that the pressure sort of like shifts all of a sudden. You know, for a while we come back at the beginning of the year and we think about the normal year, and then suddenly we just catapulted into a major crisis just around energy. And yet at the same time, there are quite a lot of other things that are running in the organization. So performance management is important. Frankly, because actually you get the level of exposure in CTE and your ability to go and find another job and a career job and better pay for that is actually quite high. So the retention of staff, once the performance management retaining staff and ensuring that people feel that they need compensation and some recognition for the work that they do. This assessment and audit of the DTE, we take it quite seriously. Each of the DTEs in their performance agreements have to sign off on their areas that they have responsibility for. And also one of the core areas to ensure that we stay with unqualified audits going forward. This is quite tough work given the very large transfer payments that we have to make, and invariably increasingly, which are some very stringent conditions attached, which we have to make sure with compliance by the SOE. And then in the department, we have an energy efficiency complaint, which is around trying to achieve 30% efficiency in consumption by ourselves. And we have actually been doing quite a few things to ensure that we're able to measure our utilization and what we do. So we think it's a crucial step at the core department in the process of ESCOM that we have to show that it's doable. And also one of the things is to try and create sort of like a base case study that other departments can use going forward. In the DG's office, particularly focused on the work of the chief investment and portfolio manager, is the SME investment dashboard. What we're trying to get to here is to a point where you are able to print out some basic analysis data, and then be able to have the SOEs download information directly into our system. One core constraint historically with this is that we move the issue of providing security of our IT system. So one of the things that we've done here is getting a closed source service provider for IT to ensure that it is secure as you can get it, and also of the policy that we would be able to get downloaded easily from the SOEs. It helps with the oversight, because many teams are probably using some of the target dates that people have indicated to get quarterly assessments are quite tight. And that actually only happens if you have a system which can trust to electronically deliver the results. We have to close on a proposal of capitalization and dividend policy that either ends with the Minister of Business Cabinet. we shall do a rolling quality review, performance review for employees that will be produced during the course of the year as part of our annual results, and the assessment of employee restructuring. And this is trying to look at the beginning of this administration, which is not getting to an end. Most of the employees have been turnaround in this restructuring program. We want to do a final report which looks at how far they've come in that part and what are the next steps going forward. And then also continue to provide oversight over significant transactions. The budget for this area remains much unchanged. We centralized much of the support budget for the department, stationary training, telephones, and medical analysis, and software acquisition, recruitment forms paid for one central area. And all of the interns are sort of located organizationally within administration.
Maybe just picking up before you go on to program, because I think you're getting into some of the individual programs that you wanted to do separately. And if you want, I think we could, when we get into each of those, we must ask you to do a broad overview first and then go into the specific programs. Because the other problem that we have at one of time is now that we need to engage with this before lunch, and I have been pulled away to a meeting that so my suggestion is that we leave the rest of the presentation and give us as and when we get to those individuals. We've already done the administration program. Members, questions? Mr. Henderson, Dr. Fanita.
Chairperson, in both the areas of national strategy as well as in the DG's presentation, you raised the importance of quarterly reports to the department. The question I have, that I noted right at the beginning when the minister was still speaking, was that does DG have the necessary expertise to deal with this? And then in the DG's presentation, she again emphasized the importance of them having the correct analysis and correct information so that they can feed some of these things to their board members. So that they can ask the correct questions. I just add that it might be useful to find on some of the questions to the portfolio committee also. Chairperson, also along with that is if we look at this here towards the end now, the vacancies now. Those vacancies there, I mean it's quite scary to see how long they've been vacant. Were there any such people in those posts before or the newly created posts? With regard to the expertise. And also the resignation, where were these resignations? I see there are some people where the contract expired. Transfers, like, was it within the department, was it to SOEs or somewhere else in the state, was it transfers? But the resignations, if you could give us, what was the breakdown? Where were these people working or resigned? What are what the reasons were just for the in-house? Chairperson, with regard to the sale of non-core properties, if not today, but at another stage, maybe later in the week, you could give us a list, not a detailed list, but a list in terms of how many of those properties were sold, transferred, whatever, to educational institutions, how much for housing and how much for private sector. Yes. And then just one other comment. My last comment for now is, you know, earlier, like it was last year, I mentioned this question of solar heating, solar geysers. Now, for a homeowner, it's an expensive investment. It will take me probably 10 years or more to get my money back from that. So I would look at it as putting in money into my home. But for Eskom, they have another priority, which is to save power and not to save money. And what is the program, or how far is the program, isn't it, to, I don't know, substantially subsidize solar heaters for private ammonia?
Thank you, Chair. We've got part of the presentation in the document. The budget vote was 30. I just looked at that because it was part of the presentation. Yeah. If you go back to 2004, then it was vote number 9, the same across all the budget documents. In 2004, the department said in the strategic overview, that is the introduction of the budget, the big red budget document, the information from the vote. The department said in preparation for the downscaling of restructuring activities, the department will be placing more emphasis on corporate governance, performance management and risk management over the medium term. Now the question is, what happened to the risk management since that time, referring now to ESCOM? Then it also says the focus on the energy sector will be on the division and incorporation of ESCOM business units and the introduction of competition in the generation of electricity. What has happened with that? Also, ESCOM is still a monopoly, and there is very little private intervention in the provision of electricity. In 2005, it was vote number 9. Here, the department said, exercise strong oversight. The measurable objective of the department is to exercise strong oversight of SOEs and the impact in the economy, and monitor the vulnerabilities of SOEs through risk management framework. Now, again, what happened with the risk management in that regard? They also said ESCOM and Transnet have been identified as key contributors to economic growth and investment in the country's transport and logistics and energy system. Now, if they were identified as that role, why didn't the department look into the sustainability of the generation of power at that stage? 2006, Chairperson, the department says, 2006, the name ESCOM does not appear, nothing, nowhere in the introduction of this budget vote of the department. So they, in 2006, ESCOM was forgotten. Then in 2007, the department, then it was vote 30. This year it's still vote 30. The department said to provide in-depth analysis of the strategic, financial, operational, and socio-economic performance of ESCOM, and oversee the establishment and monitoring of broadband infrastructure. Now, if they look in, if they provide an in-depth analysis of the strategic and operational performance of ESCOM, why was the department then in the dark about what was going to happen? It doesn't make sense. Chairperson, now in this boat in front of us today, I must just make the observation that up to date the department was very quiet on the 1st January on this whole ESCOM issue. They left everything for ESCOM and the minister to react on the crisis, and we heard very little from the department. But in this document, I would like to ask the DG, in program 2, the heading is Energy and Broadband Enterprises. And then it's been said here to monitor ESCOM's capacity expansion program to ensure timely delivery of new...
Reminded that we're going to get this program to ESCOM.
Okay.
Okay,
just...
All of the other questions that you posed to the DG.
Okay, well,
you can have a second round of the question.
Well, this is part of the first question. It's the last part of the first question.
I'll get on the program.
Okay. And then...
Yes.
Okay, then check this on this doctor's presentation. One
last
question. Yeah, it's the last one. Referring to the opening speech of the President, he referred to that certain vacancies in the public sector and all tiers of government should be filled within 6 months. Now, if we look on page 19 of this presentation, you know, there are vacancies for many days, I just want to know, vacancy period, 90 days, 540 days, etc. What are the guys to do to comply with the statement mentioned by the president in the opening speech? Thank you.
A lot of those questions were already posed to the minister, so I hope you've synchronized your answers nicely. Dr. Van Dijk didn't like the minister's answers, so you're going to give it up.
Yeah.
If you
don't like the answers by the minister, you also can
close
the question.
No, no, I won't do that.
Or the
DGs. I'll get my opportunity.
Or when the DGs got you, then the DGs.
Okay. That sounds like a
thing.
No, no, Chef, mine is on page 7, around the issue of fraud and intraco. Around the issue of comments and concerns. I could not capture very well the issue exactly what will be the challenge there between the AWCC and the Interpac cable. Exactly what are the challenges there. But Chair, I'm linking that with what I said either in terms of where are these two departments does with their colleagues in terms of able to communicate each other, although the minister responded, that's what I said, in Franco and Center. But it goes deeper than that because of the cables and other things, whether, but I'm not sure what was the comment of the CC, because I also went out, just as my apologies, the chief who was just outside the door, calling and so on. I thought I'm going to be taking, going home, but I'm thinking, yes, I'm here.
I'm also happy considering you'll be chairing the next session, so make sure you hear the next session. I'm just going to give the chief of the call to ask you to call you up. But look, I think the last issue about the broadband in Chicago and the entire table is that on the one thing that worries, I think, a little bit about the issue of issues, shall I say, of timelines. If you look at Alice Cook, for example, the long-term business, and I know that there's a lot of outstanding stuff with the schooling and sharing conversation and so on, still taking place. But part of the difficulty, of course, is that the longer this process drags out, the worse your entity begins to look in terms of its financials and so on. So it really becomes quite important that certain timelines are worked towards. Likewise, also with Infraco, you're talking about trying to attract some partnerships, and clearly that affects to a large extent the funding impediments for the venture. But again, we don't know that you set yourself some targets in terms of timeline. What if, the private sector is not interested anymore, or if they are they able to come to the party time with you? Because clearly, if you're going to say that one of the things that we want is the infrastructure in place for which is 2010, then clearly we need to see cycle timelines, stuff that we can measure you against, and that we can actually have discussions on. So those issues become quite important. Again, the South African Airways, the restructuring and the CBRI restructuring program is not being agreed to, and so on. But exactly how is it, and what are the timelines for implementation, and what are the KPIs towards seeing the restructuring happening? Clearly, you anticipating to fund SAA once some of those restructuring changes. It seems to me that if you're going to be in discussions with Treasury on those, or Cabinet, or whatever else you're going to be negotiating this particular investment into, it seems to me that you have to go to them with a lot more than trying to get this thing out. So maybe if you could just
give us some comments. We will, of course, deal with some of the details that we get into the business plan.
Thank you, Jim. We do the quarterly report at the current moment, and we have been doing this for quite some time. And it's only because the quality has improved over the period of time that we feel that maybe we're ready to take a try to go beyond the minister and make these a little bit more broadly available. That's just guidelines of what it is that we see in the enterprise in terms of performance. The positions that we indicated that were vacant, the rail and aviation specialists, those were new positions that we created. It's not that there were people previously in them. And the core issue around those was that we were looking for people who had significant experience in aviation and who had significant experience in rail as well. In the previous financial years, you will recall that we had the visit funded program, and the visit funded program helped a lot in securing our specialists for some of these areas, so we were able to do quite a lot of work despite not being able to acquire our own full-time staff, but since the program has ended. If I can tie that up with the question from Dr. Van Dyke around the president's injunction that positions being filled, in as far as, you know, even the 540 days, it's not 540 days of vacancy us doing nothing. It's 540 days where they are airbound to try to find people and anything like. So beyond a certain point, if you can't find the skills, you can't create them, sort of thing. So we have to, and filling positions in the public service is subject to public service rules. We will be engaging with the Director General in the department around some of these positions where sometimes it's very effective. Most people, even who operate in Transnet or even the SAA, would be operative people who are not policy people. So it is about trying to get people with serious experience behind them to these positions. But it's not for want of trying. And the director from the presidency was around senior positions, especially DDGs and director general. Those positions have to be filled across the civil service. So in as far as that's concerned, you have the 120 days that it's taken for us. It's just the cabinet process and the vetting process that determines how quickly you can fill the DDG to the ship. So we watch it. I mean, it's not, for us, it's the area of concern, especially in the specialist areas, that we have to try and find people somehow. But it's a core area of focus. Caroline will be able to give the data of how much Caroline participants will be in the presentation when we do JPS on the non-core properties for them, if you don't mind leaving up to that. On the solar heating, we are working with ESCOM DME and DME and had approached Treasury around us for the support that would assist at least in the first 3 years with a movement towards solar water heating, but also talking to the industry around dealing with pricing, and DTI is also looking at how we could reduce the cost of solar water heating in South Africa so that it becomes a lot more affordable, but also been talking to banks around making sure that there's financing. Because even if you did have a subsidy, it will never be 100% of the cost. You still have to fund the rest of the capital directly yourself. Furthermore, with the cost of electricity increasing, the payback period reduces significantly for solar water heating. The question of risk management, I suppose, it's an area of work that we have been looking at for a period of time. Before, we started off with developing a risk management framework across the SOEs. We also had to work with the SOEs so that we'd be able to get their risk framework. So as the first, and it's the first port of call, this gives the responsibility of the board and management to make sure that that all of the core risks of state operation are covered. So if we come to the risk that we watch at the DPE on an active basis, so clearly we've now noticed that there are issues around maintenance where we require certain questions to be asked, and I think on all of the boards this is now top of mind. It's generally the systemic risk. Now obviously maintenance, when you cause almost a collapse of the system, you have to be an area of significant concern for ourselves. If one of the things that we haven't monitored previously that we're now monitoring, because the only way that you can know that there's a problem with power stations is if you're watching what's happening to the amount of energy that's coming out of the power station, because that starts to tell you that something is not right. for the cannibalization of that power station. So in the case of this, we, if there had been a reporting of what the coal reserves, what's the quantity of the coal that's going to Eskom, there would have been some indication that your coal reserves are much lower than what you started off with. The quality of the coal has gone down, so the output from the power station has been going down. That's something that we weren't watching previously, but we now are watching it up more actively. But also, if you look at in 2004 when we approved, because it was in 2004 that we approved the investment program for Eskom, two things we approved: the investment program, the new growth program, and also the policy that 30% of new growth would come from private producers. The IPP process was run by the Department of Mineral Energy Affairs. It wasn't run directly by itself, and it said that was for our coal heating plant for 1,000 megawatts. But at the same time, Eskom also sold, so there was 1,000 megawatts that Eskom had. If you look at the annual report, you'll see that Eskom has put in quite a significant amount of megawatts since 2005. In 2005, we put in 361 million. So 6,400 additional. In 2007, 1,493, and then this year we'll be getting 1,135. So in terms of this is the megawatts that have been brought into the system going forward. And as far as the 30% has been the case, it's last year that we put out a new CAB memo, to approve the conversion of the system from to a single buyer system where Eskom is going to be the issuer of tenders to bring in private sector participation into the system. One, two. The cost of electricity in South Africa is such that there hasn't been interest by IPP. There are previous attempts before 2004 where there had been tenders out to try and get private players into the system, and hence the question of fixing the cost of electricity is quite critical. In as far as communications on Eskom, our understanding is that the minister is part of the department, and the intention was that we wouldn't have two communications on exactly the same topic. The minister was leading the communication in Eskom, there was an understanding that it would be led by Eskom. What we've been doing actively is finding solutions to deal with the problems. And that's why you're now starting to hear as the talk about what it is that you're up to. And our idea is make a lot more sense to make sure that there's a lot of work behind the scenes to ensure that there would be proper communication going out to the department. With regards to broadband infra coal, the issue raised in there is that the NEPA table is now being subsumed into what is called Hurume, which is a drain right around the continent. Now that is being coordinated by DOC because it includes also operators on the rest of the continent beyond South Africa. So one of the things that we've had to do is make sure that there's a proper working relationship between the West Coast link that would be put in by Infracoal, as well as having a decent relationship with Hurume, who are looking at putting in a cable right around the continent, and also making sure that there's synchronization in terms of which leg they do. If they do the East Coast leg first, they are then able to ride on the West Coast leg of the Infracoal cable. So it's just making sure that there's coordination as far as those projects are concerned. And as far as the working relationship with the DOC, we really, on the policy side and policy questions, we really try and keep up to date. But it's unavoidable that when we get to transactional and they're working on a different transaction and you're working on a different transaction or a different project, that there might be some divergences. And also in the stance that we've taken as CPE, these transactions, like the Alice cable, is not, we don't run with it. The company, Infracoal, is responsible to put together the companies to come on board with it. What we make sure of is the areas where approvals are required from the department or the requirements are required from the government. We take care of making sure that those are done. I think during the course of the year, we would come and report back on progress and goals and protocol. We would be able to indicate to you how far we are in the process of these. Some of these agreements, for obvious reasons, are market moving. If we suddenly tell you when we expect and how much money we expect, it becomes public information, so our ability to negotiate is somehow somewhat constrained. But we would be able to indicate what are the deadlines by which the various agreements have to be signed for us to be able to have a table on hand by 2020. I'm not sure. I mean, I'd like to hope that I've covered most of the questions. In around the... Let me quickly do FAA discussion. The FAA team will talk a little about what are the timelines that are checked and talked to them. Whatever's not confidential, we'll say, but whatever's confidential, then it's just a question if we can have a closer in terms of transfers, most of the people would transfer, there's quite a lot of people with more senior positions and transfers to other government departments directly from the departments. And there are some designations where people were able to go to much more senior positions in other areas, and sometimes also Jensen, for example, became CEO of Universal Services Agency of the DOC, and a couple of people have gone into, one individual in particular, went into the DBSA as one of the economists on the investment side. So there are some people. We actually try to keep track and also have exit interviews with people meet around where they're going to, what are they there's a good number of people who transfer within the past that in the public service itself from one department to the other. But as we indicated the data, this is what we have, some are designations, strange designations which have gone to other areas also.
Dealing with
the
transfer of the are there any other but we'll deal some more with the HR stuff in a little more detail when we deal with the sugar product. But can I just say we need to now break for lunch. We'll come back at 2. And when we do for 1, we'll take over the chair for the admin position at the very least. And then I'm not sure if maybe we shouldn't do the legal and government thing of doing the chair as well, rather than going straight to the board then. Will you guys be ready with that? Okay. Then let's do that. Let's package it that way. We'll have those two giving presentations. We'll do the two presentations up front and maybe open up those questions for some of them. Maybe they love people to do the board. Okay, lunch.
Lunch with.
Afternoon, everybody. Welcome back. I hope you enjoyed the lunch. And we are now going to carry on with our third room, which is the detailed budget presentation by Tandy Hatch. Tandy, all yours.
Good afternoon, Chair Honorable Members, thank you very much. I did a short contents page, just so you would know where everything was. And then we can move on to the next slide. This is a summary in a simplified form from the EME, which gives you a breakdown of the budget, including transfer payments for all the programs. Over the interim period, expenditure decreases at a rate of 59.1% from 4.6 billion in the current year to 315 million in 2010-11. Transfers to the SOE remain high in the first 2 years of the NTEP with a combined amount of 4.9 billion, of which 3.5 billion is allocated to the PBMR. The joint project facility is also subject to an increase in expenditure over the NTEP, rising from 14.4 million in 2002, 7 or 8 to 27 million in 2011. The next point, the next slide is the economic classification, which gives you the breakdown between current expenditure, which is compensation of employees, goods and services. Capital is also part of current expenditure as an expense. Transfers are separated as well. There's nothing in this other category. I then have also summarized the transfer payments as was presented by the DG in her presentation. However, I thought it was interesting just to note that Alex called the amount, the transfer amount in 2007-08, 2.25 million was included for VAT, but this is subject to confirmation from National Treasury and SARS, as there's a debate whether VAT is applicable to a specific portion of the funding earmarked for the restructuring of Alex Corps. It's an amount of about 16 million that is in question. In terms of SAA, 91.4 million was included for VAT as well, and this is also subject to confirmation from Treasury and SARS whether it's applicable to this nature of funding, which is being in respect of the restructuring costs. So we are waiting and we're following up rigorously with Treasury to try and have a resolution on this, because in the event that we do not draw these funds and they have to go back to the revenue fund, we will again not meet our 2% expenditure for the year. So this is debatable, and as I say, we are rigorously asking Treasury to give us an answer on that. The next slide is the operational funding that we requested. I've deliberately left the transfer payments out so that you could have an idea of what the department costs to run this department. In the intake process last year, we requested an amount of 486.646 over the 3-year period, which included the normal baseline inflationary increase as well as additional funding for projects. In December, we received our allocation letter from National Treasury in the sum of 476.216 million, which created a deficit of 10.430 million. The allocation of the first year being in deficit of 16.048, which meant that projects had to be reprioritized to the outer years. However, in January, National Treasury advised the department that the allocation had been revised to include further inflation projections. The allocation was increased from 475.916 to 517.544. A total amount of 41.628 million, which comprised 2.817 million for personnel and 58.811 million for non-personnel components of the vote by National Treasury to mitigate inflationary pressures. However, they also informed us that if the inflation outcomes are above their projections, it will be incumbent on the department to absorb the additional costs within the baseline. The second allocation, the January inflationary allocation, solved some of the issues in terms of pushing some of the projects out to the outer year, and which resulted in us being able to actually do what we wanted to do originally. I'll move on to program one. There's very little change to this program other than an inflationary increase for compensation of employees, which includes the remuneration of all 48 interns, 26 in 07-08 and 22 in 08-09. The department centralized equipment contracts, telephone stations, training, recruitment, advertising, and software licenses to administration. The interns, just for information purposes, is that we had an overlap with our interns. We were the interns were starting in April of every year, and so we decided that rather to have them for a full year from January to December, which caused us to have a 3 month overlap in at the end of this current year. So I just thought I should let you know that. Program 2, Energy Broadband and Broadband Enterprises. There's a slight increase in operational expenditure in this program over the MTEC period, which is mainly due to projects in the sector commencing in 2009-10. Over the MTEC period, a total of $727 million has been allocated for broadband InfraCo and $3.5 billion for the PDMR. However, overall expenditure in this program decreases due to the decline of transfer payments to the SOE. In his budget speech, the Minister of Finance indicated that an amount of $60 billion has been set aside in a contingency fund for his over the next 5 years, $20 billion of which is the anticipated requirement of the MTEC. The department would advise the committee as soon as this allocation has been clarified by National Treasury. The functions of funds in the mining stock program, which was previously in this program, have been moved to program 3, legal governance risk and transactions, which I will deal with in the next slide. The funding requested from Treasury for state owned and allocated by Treasury for state owned enterprises are separated out to illustrate what was requested and what we were given and the impact of the either meeting our requirements or not meeting our requirements. However, I would also like to mention that when the programs do present, they will give you more detail on what the full impact will be of those. So we requested $2.095 billion for the long-distance network and the undersea cable. However, Treasury gave us an amount of $727 million for the period, which a significant equity contribution is critical.